Okay, today is April 26, 2019, and this is Karen Brewster, and I'm here with Brooke Childrey at her home in Eatonville, Washington, near Mount Rainier, on a beautiful sunny day. And this is for the Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park Oral History Project. So, Brooke, thank you for letting me come down and visit you today.
You're welcome.
And you were the curator at Klondike Seattle, is that right?
No, not
okay.
quite.
Okay, curatorial assistant?
No, I am the curator at Mount Rainier National Park.
Okay.
And the curator of record for Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park Seattle Unit.
What does curator of record mean?
It means that up until recently, I went up to the park and helped them with their cultural resource issues, helped them with the curation issues, made sure that things were accessioned, cataloged, that sort of thing, helped researchers. I brought in interns from the University of Washington and oversaw their internships, and then started a exhibits program with the University of Washington where the park gives them themes. They design exhibits based on those themes, and then we select one of the themes to be fabricated and installed, which the students do. And then it's installed at Klondike.
Cool.
So
are those museum studies students or?
They are museology graduate students.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to take us back a little bit. When did you first start doing work for Klondike Seattle?
2008. I am still the curator of record, but in 2018 we were able to hire a museum curator, Taryn Erickson. She's a GS9. She's not a full, I think they call them journeyman curator. So I'm still their curator of record. My responsibilities have changed. So I'm now a technical person. They can call me. I can go up there, that sort of thing. But Taryn's running the whole.
You don't go up on a regular basis.
Not anymore.
So when you were curator of record, did you go up every week or?
Depended. It started out 10 days a year and turned into 3.5 pay periods a year. So just when it started 10 days, it was the superintendent would call and say, can you come up? I want to have a meeting, that sort of thing. When it turned into 3.5 pay periods, it was every other week to go up there, work on things. At one point, we were doing like every week, two days every week. So we were front loading, mm-hmm. So we were calling it, because something else was happening at Mount Rainier that I needed to not be at Klondike,
right.
Or something was happening at Klondike that I needed to be at.
Right.
So pretty flexible.
Now, why did they have you as curator of record and bring you in from Rainier instead of hiring a full curator stationed at Klondike, Seattle?
The collections at Klondike were not large enough at the time to justify having a full-time curator. The responsibilities weren't as defined at mm-hmm. the time. And so over the last 10 years, they say the responsibilities have grown. So I started out with just doing the accessioning and the cataloging. There was no exhibits program. The permanent exhibits had been installed in 2006, and that was it. So superintendents came in and came out with the superintendents, and I talked. Some of the interpretive staff got on board, and we started. There was a curator's exhibit that was supposed to be temporary to highlight what was in the collection. It had been up for 2 years. So that was the first thing that changed.
Mm-hmm.
And With interpretation's help, we started bringing in rotating exhibits about historic Seattle. And then I forget how we got the connection with University of Washington. Jacqueline or Karen might remember. But anyway, we got a connection with the University of Washington's Museology graduate program. And the first year, they just designed exhibits. I think they called us and said, hey, we're looking for museums to help us with our class. Could you give us some themes? And the students will design exhibits. So the first year, it was just designing. Then they, second year, 2010, 2011 or 12, they expanded the program, decided to have two classes. So the first class was in the wintertime, and they designed exhibits, and then they fabricated in the fall. They still do that. They've now, this year, added a third class. So in the winter, they design. In the spring, they go more in-depth on their designs, more research, that sort of thing. And then in the fall, the one design that's selected will then be fabricated and installed, and the exhibit will open the 1st of December and run until at least till April. It just depends on the quality of the exhibit and whether we have something else coming in after it. So the very first exhibit was actually on the Elwha River, the dams on the Elwha River, up at Olympic National Park.
Okay.
And that exhibit was fantastic. It was very well received. The natives came to see it. Locals and dignitaries from the area came in and saw it. The students went above and beyond, and they set the bar high for all the other students following them, which is why we now have three classes.
Right.
To give them that more time to do the research, because the Elwha crew, they went on their days, you know, outside of school hours, weekends, and went up to Olympic to do the research.
Yeah.
So, so you can see, we don't just do the Klondike.
Well, that was my question. That was what I was going to ask. Is, oh, so you don't just do Klondike?
No, we have criteria. The criteria started out with it has to be a Klondike theme, which means it has to be about the Klondike Gold Rush. Or Seattle's involvement in the Klondike Gold Rush. It then expanded with discussions with the regional office, who said, you know, you guys are located in the a perfect spot to tell
the
national park story. So could you tell, in your exhibit space that you have, could you tell stories about some of the parks and what's going on in the parks in this region? So, it actually, it's not the region, it's the network. So we can do Klondike. We can do historic Seattle's role in the Klondike Gold Rush. We can do things that are happening in the parks within our network. So science. One year we did Fishers, the reintroduction of Fishers in the big national parks. Olympic, North Cascades, and Mount Rainier. We can do a theme that is related to something that is significant to the National Park Service. So we did the centennial of the National Park Service. This year, I don't know all of the themes because Taryn's taking over, so I only know the one that affects my work at Mount Rainier. They're doing climate change.
I was going to ask, well, climate change.
So there's a lot. Klondike, Seattle, is, what's it called now? It's got, it's expanded.
The name of it?
Yeah, so it's still Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park, Seattle.
Seattle unit, yeah.
But their responsibilities have expanded. They now are the NPS liaison for the Wing Luke Asian Pacific, I'm going to shut it off, museum. It's a really long title. They are the liaison for the Bainbridge Island Exclusion Memorial, which is part of Minidoka National Historical Park. But
which was one
they're
of the
Idaho.
Internment camp.
Right, the first internment camp during World War II was at Bainbridge. But because it's closer to Seattle, even though it's
part of Minidoka.
It's right, it's part of Minidoka. We're the ones that staff it and oversee it on their behalf. So our responsibility is expanded. With that is partnerships with Historic Seattle and Wing Luke and Bainbridge. So the curator position, instead of just being accession and catalog stuff that's coming in that we're receiving over the two, you know, in between the times you're coming up, is now being a liaison, acting as a liaison for the university, for the Wing Luke Museum, for Bainbridge Island, for Historic Seattle. The responsibilities have expanded. You're also responsible for cultural resources. There is no other cultural resource person on staff.
Oh, really? There isn't?
No. It's a staff of interpreters and a curator.
And no historian?
No historian. No maintenance. So you have the park superintendent. You have administrative assistant, a chief ranger interpretation, an education specialist, and interpreters. And then they had me. And
right.
Working with Karen and Jacqueline, we were able to first get seasonal museum tech. Then we were able to get a museum tech full-time. And then working with Charles, we were able to say, okay, well, if we look at what the responsibilities are, what her workload is, this really is
right.
9 or 11. We were hoping for an 11, but they didn't have the budget for
right.
it.
Right. And so Karen and Jacqueline are...
Karen and Jacqueline were superintendents.
So what's Karen's last name?
Bipler Dorn.
Okay. And then Jacqueline was...
Ashwell. She was the superintendent after Karen. And Charles's Bill is the current superintendent.
What's Jacqueline's last name?
Ashwell.
Okay. Is she the one who's in Hawaii now?
She's in Hawaii now. Yeah, so the three of them were what I would call forward-thinking.
Mm-hmm.
They recognized that without the collections, without a collections manager, somebody was dealing with the cultural resources because they're in a historic building.
Right.
That the park, it was the primary resource. It was the reason the park was established.
Right.
That unit was established. Was to exhibit artifacts.
Right.
So they realized that and worked diligently to expand the responsibilities and look for the budget to make it happen.
Well, I'd say it's the collection of artifacts and the use of those to tell the story. Whereas I'd say other parks, their collections are, you know, plant samples and archaeological excavations and photos and artifacts, but they're not all designed to be seen and used by the public.
Right.
And I would think Klondike Seattle would have more for exhibits than just collections.
Yes, the majority of the collection is on exhibit.
Yeah.
So, but it was specifically when Klondike Skagway and Klondike Seattle were established. He had the same superintendents.
Right.
And if you look at the documentation, it says, you know, we need to collect artifacts for Seattle so we can open an exhibit to the public, to bring the public in and teach them about Seattle's right. role in the Klondike Gold right. Rush. So without those resources, without the collections, there isn't a park.
Right.
And that's what these last three superintendents have realized, and that's what was driving force behind expanding the role of the curator and bringing on museum tech and working with the university and all that stuff.
Right.
So.
Okay, I'm going to take us back in time, which is what I usually start with, but I wanted to first hear a little bit about the kind of work you did. So to take us back is your personal history, where you're from, how your education, how you got to be doing curatorial work.
Yeah. It's a long story. I have a degree from Oregon State University. My degree is in resource management and zoology. So when I graduated, I immediately, on graduation day, started working for the Park Service. And I was working for interpretation at Crater Lake. And I worked there 2 seasons.
What year would that have been?
1985 okay. and 1986. And in 1986, Abraham Lincoln's home in Springfield, Illinois started calling me. And I had to keep putting them off because of family stuff that was going on. And they kept calling. And so once the family stuff was over, I accepted the position there. And I was an interpreter at Crater Lake, and I was an interpreter at Lincoln Home. But at Lincoln's home, they got funding for a restoration project that they weren't aware they were receiving funding for. And the project was to completely dismantle the home. And then do an archaeological excavation underneath, and then put it all back together.
Wow.
Unfortunately, because they didn't know it was a last minute, we have extra money, let's do this project, their museum technician had been detailed out.
Oh.
So there was nobody on staff to deal with the collection, which was in the house. It was a house.
Yeah, if you're going to take it down, you have to record it all first.
Right, so that was my job. I was selected out of everybody on staff to take care of the collection, and so I had to inventory it. I had to make decisions as to whether or not it needed conservation treatment before it went back out on exhibit. This is doing, having no experience whatsoever. pack it up, find a temporary storage facility that was climate controlled, all that stuff. I worked with conservators at Harper's Ferry and did all of this. It took 7 or 8 months of my time, and the end result was, this is kind of something I was getting it organized and figuring all this out was something I really liked doing. Mm-hmm. It was like a jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah.
and trying to figure it all out, and it was tangible. It was Abraham Lincoln's things, so you could relate to it. So after I left Lincoln Home, they helped me transfer to Boston National Historical Park. And I transferred as an interpreter, but was picked up right away as their museum technician.
What is Boston National Historical Park?
Boston National Historical Park is the USS Constitution, the USS Cassin Young, the Freedom Trail, so Paul Revere's house, Old North Church, Bunker Hill Monument. It's Revolutionary War. And it goes all the way through actually through Nixon.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he decommissioned the Naval Shipyard at the time, because this Boston Naval Shipyard is part of all of that.
Okay.
So I became their museum technician. That was my first curatorial job. I spent we went to training, museum methods training, back when they had it, back then. And I was lucky, I was in the Northeast region, or what was called the North Atlantic region at the time. And regional curator of the North Atlantic / Northeast region was John Mayonis, and he held follow-up classes for 2 years.
Wow.
And so for 2 years, we would meet with John, and he would teach us something about curation that we needed to know. So he taught us how to photograph artifacts. He taught us how to do environmental monitoring, you know, everything that, right. that you need to know how to do it. It was before museum studies was ever offered in the universities. And then from there, I became the first curator for Acadia National Park and St. Croix Island International Historical Site.
You see, and there's an...
Oh. Sorry.
Is that your phone or your computer?
Computer.
Okay. You see, there you go. Acadia National Park, I think of as beautiful landscape and the wagon roads, trail system and all that. You don't think of a collection that needs to be curated.
It's huge.
Maybe the plant and bird samples?
I don't know. Acadia has both. That was the first park where I actually used the training that I had from Oregon State, all that natural history stuff. It has natural history. It has collection baseline data from the 1800s of insects that were collected and specimens that were collected by William H. Procter. You think of Procter & Gamble toothpaste and stuff. William was one of the, what do you call them? He was part of the Procter family, and he was taking care of the company.
Oh, you like being the president or something.
Yeah, it'll come to me probably in the middle of the night. But he would rather go out and collect specimens, so he ditched the life of Procter & Gamble. Again, it was before it became Procter & Gamble. It was just Procter at the time. And so he was collecting, and his collection is huge. There's like 20,000 specimens that he alone collected.
Now, are there cultural artifacts?
Absolutely. Acadia National Park's on an island in Maine, and there are 2,000 islands in the archipelago. And so Mount Desert Island, and then there's two Cranberry Islands, and it's five islands. Mount Desert, Cranberry, Sutton Island, and this little one is Bear something. Anyway, so they're all part of Acadia National Park. There's some aspect of stuff that we own. The Cranberry Islands Museum out on Little Cranberry Island was donated to the park by William Otis Sawtelle. He collected about the history of the islands, that set of five islands, and that history goes all the way back to King Henry IV.
Okay.
And so the documents, the archives that are in the collection, the objects in the collection there pertain to the islands. So like I say, they go back to, they're French settlers, so they go back to King Henry the IV, King Louis the 13th and 14th. Don't ask me why, but Diamond Jim Brady, who was a gambler.
Yeah.
Well, apparently he had some connection to the islands.
Well, I was going to say there was also a Native history, I'm sure.
There is Native American history. The Wabanaki tribes of Maine. It's a group of tribes that, when NAGPRA came through, the Native American
Graves Repatriation Act.
Yep. When that came through, Maine was the first one that got their act together, and instead of each tribe competing for human remains and funerary objects, they banded together as the Wabanaki. And so the collections were repatriated immediately. And there's the Abbey Museum, which is also on Mount Desert Island. And we work closely with them to make sure those sort of things happen.
Okay. So how long were you at Acadia?
10 years. Acadia and St. Croix.
Wow.
So St. Croix Island is the first settlement by Europeans in the New World. It's not Jamestown.
No, I think of Labrador, Newfoundland, with the Vikings.
Well, probably. I guess that would be North America, too. So
maybe Newfoundland, maybe it's because it's off the coast. I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah, I don't think that anybody can say. I don't know why we don't. But anyway, they were settled in 1604. Jamestown was settled in 1607. So they settled St. Croix in 1604. There were something like 74 settlers. It was the worst winter on record ever. And they did right. I mean, they built their fort here on the island. They built their garden over here on the mainland. And then everything froze, and they couldn't get from here to there to get to the vegetables. So they literally died from complications of scurvy, but not all of them. Those that survived, because of the latitude longitude of France, which is where they're from, they in France, if you go north, it's warmer. And they were thinking the same thing would happen in North America, so they went north and they settled Quebec.
Oh.
So they are Acadians. During the wars with Britain. So Britain claimed north-south. Mm-hmm. France claimed east-west.
Okay.
So they claimed all North America.
Right.
And Britain claimed here. So every time they were battling over who had
and
what.
There were lots of those battles.
Yeah, they either went north towards Quebec or they went south and inland to, do you know where?
Mm-mm.
Jazz country. New Orleans. Yep, those are Acadians.
Oh, that's right, they are.
Yeah, so they came from Acadia.
Right.
So, St. Croix Island International Historical Park is the island they settled.
Okay.
It is an international park between Canada and the United States, and it literally sits in the middle of the water. So, the collections there are primarily archaeological.
Right.
They excavated the island and re-excavated it and excavated it again. It's primarily archaeological. As I left from there, we were building up. We had inherited property, and so they were building up the visitor program and that sort of thing.
And then did you come here to Washington?
Came to Mount Rainier in November of 2005, and I've been here ever since.
Nice.
And then, like I say, in 2008, I was informed I was curator of record at Klondike.
Right. So you didn't had no choice in the matter.
No, I was actually reading it in some document and called the regional curator and said, "Kent, what is this?" And he said, "Oh yeah, I assigned you Klondike," and he assigned Gay. At Olympic, she had Hawaii, and Kelly at North Cascades had Eby's Landing and San Juan's. So.
And that was just because those were smaller collections that couldn't justify having a position.
Right, and then the Pacific Northwest region, Kent Bush was the regional curator, and Diane Nicholson was for the Pacific West, and then they combined the two regions and made one region. And both of them were working the same way. We're a big region. We have lots of parks, but we have no curators.
Yeah.
Literally, there were no curators. Yellowstone, Yosemite had a curator and archivist staff.
Right.
But the rest of the parks didn't until very recently.
Wow. So, well, and it's interesting that they assign you from Rainier to Seattle rather than somebody from Skagway when those two units are connected. But I guess it's closer to come from Rainier.
Right, right. Exactly. So, and they're in a different region.
I have a question about that, but I want to... You mentioned going to Oregon
State.
Were you from Oregon originally? Where did you grow up?
Yeah. So I spent 20 years trying to get back from the East Coast. But when I started in the Park Service, that's what you had to do. You had to go east to get permanent, and then you have to work your way back.
Uh-huh.
So, and it's okay because I've seen quite a few national parks. And
well, and it sounds like all your curatorial work has been sort of on-the-job training.
It has. When I was in Boston, the regional curator sent me to Harvard University when they started having a museum studies program. But I never finished that program because he had, at that point, convinced the superintendent at Acadia National Park that they needed a curator.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of what Diane and Kent had to do out here, was work on superintendents and convince them that they needed curators. So Rainier, the first curator, came in December of 98, and she was a third-person interpreter. So she was an interpreter who did third-person interpretation, costume interpretation. But she was a hardship transfer, so she had no curation background whatsoever. She provided access to the collection, but not processing. Processing and actually preserving the collections didn't start until I came in December of 2005.
Wow.
And Gay, I think, Mary was hired in 2005 at Crater Lake. Gay was hired, I think, in 2005 or 2004 at Olympic. So we're talking, the late 90s, early 2000s, before curation in the Pacific Northwest happened.
And does that coincide with a change in academic professional training that now is available? So people came in as already as curator?
When I went to Harvard, it was started out as certificate programs. And I think, I want to say, and I could be remembering wrong, University of Oklahoma had a online, but you had to show up at Oklahoma for like a month at some point in time of your studies. And I think that was an actual degree, a master's degree. Mm-hmm. And now lots of them have them, and I'm starting to see more and more that have bachelor's degrees in it.
And that's like in museum studies or curation. Or
what about archives? There's still museum studies certificates, but more and more universities are offering museum studies master's degrees, and some are offering bachelor's degrees.
Yeah, and it's different than being trained as an archivist?
Oh, yes, they're totally different.
In what way?
Museum studies is cultural and natural artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
Some archives, administration, running a museum, a full-blown museum, art history and exhibits, registration, big on registration. Archives is... it's all two-dimensional. So you're dealing with paper, your photographs, magnetic media, that sort of thing.
Recordings,
right. Not so much three-dimensional objects.
Okay.
It's a different skill set. And it's kind of a different way of doing things. Like, if I'm cataloging... I'm writing numbers on things.
Mm-hmm.
Archivists don't.
No.
They'll write it on the folder, but they won't write it on the artifact unless the artifact goes out on display. Sorry. Got a frog in my throat.
Yeah, a sip of water. So what are the different skill sets?
I'm not an archivist.
No, well, I guess what would you say? You said you sort of fell into this curation work and it's something you enjoyed. And
right.
So what is it that you think makes you, what skills do you think you have that make you able to do curation work?
Well, I know that I'm, the parks that I have moved to are parks that needed somebody to come in and organize the collections. So that's my skill set. I come in and I organize the collection, meaning I track down the registration information. I make sure that they're tagged and properly housed. I'll go find collections. So I found the Proctor collection when I was at Acadia. It had been missing. They thought it had burned in the fire, Mount Desert Island fire, in the 1940s. I found it in Massachusetts, the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and brought it back to Acadia. So that's my skill set, is digging into all of this, figuring it all out, and getting it all organized. Other people are sort of the historian side of things. They are object specialists. They know exactly what this object is. They know what every piece of that object is. That's not my skill set. I'm what would be called a generalist. Mm-hmm. In the sense, I can come into any park and do my job. I can accession, I can catalog, I can organize.
Right.
And others are specialists. You have your art historians who specifically deal with just artwork.
Right. Or like or a conservator. Like, you're not a conservator, but you can tell if something needs help, and you bring a conservator in to preserve
it. Right, because of the training that the Park Service provided. Yeah. And I do have some conservation training, so they did teach me how to conserve wood and how to conserve metals. To a certain point, you have to send it to a conservator to deal with.
Yeah. And there are even fewer of those around.
There are now, yes, a lot fewer. The archivist side of things, the regional archivist, we used to have a regional archivist here. It was a term position. We don't have a regional archivist in this region at this point. His skill set was being able to come in, look at a record and documents and tell you if they were government records or not. So we have historical archives, things that are being donated by visitors, and then we have government records. And everything that we create, like what you're creating right now, mm-hmm. they deem, is it a government record or is it a non-record? And our archivists could come in and say in seconds, he just knew, that's a record, that's not a record, you know. And he knew disposition schedules, how long he had to keep it, if he had to keep it at all. He knew all of that, but he also knows how to preserve paper documents or magnetic media, that sort of thing,
right.
And what will make it last the longest. The goal is 1,000 years.
Yeah.
So he knows what containers work and don't work. So as curators, we have that basic training, so we can do some of it. But like here at Mount Rainier, I'll do the smaller collections, but I will send the bigger collections to Yosemite, or contract for people at Yosemite to come up and do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because they know how to do all the different types. They know how to handle a blueprint versus a D'Azio type, you know, versus a photograph. They know how to do all of that, and they can do it quickly, whereas I have to sit there and do the research each and every time.
Right, and Klondike Unit, have they had an archivist?
No.
So no curator or archivist?
No. When I became curator of record, they had a park ranger, Keith Routley, who had other duties as assigned to deal with the collections. But they rightly hired him from the University of Washington's Museology graduate program. So he had training as a museum person, but not as a National Park Service museum person.
Right.
How the Park Service deals with its collections is different than how, Seattle?
Burke Museum.
Burke Museum, stuff like that. They deal with it differently than the Park Service does.
How so? How does the parks...
Well, we have a different cataloging program altogether.
You mean like on a computer program?
Right. So we use what's called, it's changing, but it's called the Interior Collections Management System. And we will, how do I say it? So like in archives, in the Park Service, we lock catalog. So if a collection comes in, whether it's one item or a million items, from an individual, gets the same catalog number and same accession number. whereas other places will individually catalog their archives. We lot catalog them.
Well, so if it's like John Smith donates 1,000 items, it's not, let's say, you know, it's 2019-1, the first collection, -01, the first item in that collection, -02?
No, that's non-Park Service.
Okay.
Park Service would be KLSE. 2019? Nope.
No?
So KLSE 29 is the catalog number. KLSE dash 29 is the accession number.
Oh, that's so totally different.
Uh-huh. Right.
How do you keep track of all those 1,000 items in that person's collection, for example?
We create a finding aid. So it's basically a box and folder list of what's in it. Each accession, you have multiple accessions. You have multiple accessions within the same catalog number for archives.
Yeah, I'm used to the year, which accession of the year it is, and then each item has a number.
Yeah.
And no, so I can't fathom how
I
do
don't
it.
Even know that system.
So. Yeah, that's the system I know. I'm like, how can you just do it as a big lot? Because how would you ever find anything? What if somebody wants to find that rusty nail? It doesn't have a number on it.
No, objects are different. Objects all get their own individual catalog numbers unless they're archaeology. Then they get them by bag.
Oh, so you're saying that lot cataloging is for the archival material.
For the archives. Okay. But we will lot catalog objects if they're exactly the same. So, for example, at Boston, I had literally, it was a wire cage box that was probably 4 feet high, 4 feet square, full of battle helmets.
Oh.
And all the battle helmets got the same catalog number except one.
Because it had a bullet hole in it or something.
It had a drawing inside.
Oh, cool.
Whoever had that helmet did a drawing inside of his helmet. So that one got an individual catalog number. But all the rest look identical. So they got the same number. For natural history specimens, insects, birds, mammals, they get individual numbers except for vials of wet specimens. The vial gets a number.
Right.
For objects, they get individual numbers unless they're identical.
And so at Klondike, they obviously have photographs.
We have photographs, yeah.
And those are all numbered individually?
No, those are archives.
They're lot numbered.
They're lot catalogs.
So how would somebody, if they want to see, you know, do you have a photo of, you know, my grandfather, so-and-so? There's no, how do you find photos in a collection that's not individually cataloged?
We have a finding aid. So the finding aid will have, it's based on the folder.
Right.
So the folder will say, like, Soapy Smith. And so all the photos of Soapy Smith are in that folder.
Within that collection, not
right.
Not all the photos from cross collections. Okay.
Right. So, and it's all computerized. So right. I can just put in Soapy Smith and it'll bring up every folder that's got Soapy Smith in it.
Okay.
So it's kind of like Christmas. There are stuff in there that you don't know and it's like, hey, never knew this was here.
Well, that's what I think the fun thing about curatorial work, whether it's archives or museum objects, the things you must come across, like that helmet with the drawings on it, or
right,
you know, because so, you're the one who gets to look at everything.
Exactly. At Rainier, what we did was we worked with the staff, and we said, okay, we have over 70,000 photographs. How do you want us to categorize these so that it'll be easy for you to retrieve them? And they chose geographically, and then within that, so paradise, buildings, so it was structures,
mm-hmm.
Equipment, roads, that sort of thing. So if you want to find the guidehouse, you're going to first go paradise, then you're going to go structures, then you're going to go guidehouse.
And what about for Klondike?
Klondike is not that detailed. They don't have 70,000 photographs. Okay. They have to worry about that. So they are within the collections. So, like the Hillshire collections, it'll say photographs, and you can go through and look at the photographs.
But it won't say, like buildings or, the Chilkoot Trail, or it's not that.
It might say Chilkoot Trail. It just depends on how detailed the archivist got when they were processing it.
Mm-hmm.
I can't off the top of my head. Without looking at it, I can't tell you.
I'd
have to look at the finding aid, and nothing's coming up right now. Right. So.
No, I was thinking about, when you know, things you dealt with when you were there, and just how people go and find things again.
We use the Klondike, Seattle uses their finding aid more frequently than we use it at Mount Rainier.
Hmm. Why is that?
More. Because they're more into research. Their staff, their interpreters. The key is to get interpretation on board. And most parks don't have interpretation on board for curation.
Mm-hmm.
Klondike does. They're like in the same building. They're right next to each other.
Right.
And if you want to do anything in interpretation, you have to go see their curator down the hallway. Because they're in charge of all of the collection, collection, the museum collection, they were in charge of all of it.
Right. Well, that was one of my questions from the beginning when you talked about getting these student interns and doing exhibits and just the asking about that connection between interpretation and exhibit staff and curatorial staff and how that meshes.
Yeah, Klondike, the exhibits program is under curation.
And that's unusual?
Yes. Most parks, it's under interpretation. So even Mount Rainier, it's under interpretation. At Klondike, Seattle, it is the responsibility of the museum curator to do the collections and to do the exhibits. That does not mean that interpretation doesn't come up with ideas and do their own exhibits. We had Ruth Kerr, who did beautiful exhibits. She worked with Historic Seattle and different businesses in Seattle and came up with some rotating exhibits that we put up while she was there. We work with interpretation. They help with identifying themes. They help with reviewing exhibits. So like our liaison with the University of Washington, interpretation throws in theme ideas, and they will review the exhibit designs. They will assist with the development of the exhibits. So we require that the students come up with press releases, with like little coffee cards to go in the coffee shops around town, because there's a million of them. That sort of thing. Interpretation is involved in all of that. We don't do the press release in curation. That's an interpretation role. They do that. The students work directly with the person responsible for press releases.
Yeah, it seems to me like exhibit work would have to be a collaboration between curatorial staff and interpretation staff in any park.
It should be, yes. At Klondike also, we have there's an education program, an education coordinator, and they work closely with the curator on all the exhibits to make sure there is an educational component to every exhibit that goes up. So
yeah, I think that's sort of the point of exhibits, right?
Right.
Is to educate.
Well, it's there's the exhibits that I'm produced or Taryn's producing or the university students are producing are going for a certain audience. And then we have a requirement that they also hit it's like third, fourth, fifth grade level. That there's some kids' activity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where our education coordinator comes in. She oversees that, helps the students to define it and refine it so that by the time it hits fabrication time, it's a full-blown component of the exhibit.
So the education person does that education person help review the text of the exhibit and all that kind of stuff as well?
Yeah, yeah.
To make sure it fits the right level, reading levels and all those things?
Yes, yes. So, it's a Klondike Seattle is a small staff, and because they're a small staff, it requires that everybody cross and work together as a team to make things happen. So it doesn't matter what you're doing. If you need help, you just go down the hallway and say, I need help. Can somebody come help me for a little bit?
But that's not typical for parks?
Not for your big parks. Acadia, it was. It's not. It's sort of a medium-sized park. So if I needed anything, I could call maintenance up, or I could call interpretation or law enforcement. They come over and help. At each of the parks I've worked at, we have to do what's called an annual inventory. And I was able to, at every park, still working on this one, to get people from every division to do those annual inventories. Got them into the collections, interested in the collections, and they started thinking about ways that they could use the collections for their interpretive programs, for restoration programs, you know, restoration of buildings, facilities, that sort of thing. So Klondike, that's the way it's done. The superintendent, all the way down to the GS3 interpreter, is involved in the annual inventory. They all donate their time to get it done.
So that means that the superintendent has a sense of what's in the collections.
Absolutely, yep.
Which makes sense.
Yeah, and it was the same at Acadia. The superintendent and all the other staff were involved.
Right.
We don't need the entire staff. I mean, at Acadia there was like 250 people.
Right. But it does make sense.
But, you know, you have it in the wintertime and, you know.
Well, I say, it does make sense that the superintendent at least has a sense of what is there, so they, when they go advocate on behalf of their park for funding or
right,
whatever, that they're informed.
Right, and they have an idea. I mean, I don't know if you could ask Charles what his favorite item in the collections is, but he knows about the collections. He's,
right.
He's been there. He's had to handle it to do the inventories.
Do you have a favorite item in the Klondike Seattle collection?
I have the same favorite item that Keith Routley has, but for different reasons.
Okay.
It's the John Hilscher collection. And the John Hilscher collection literally walked through the door one day.
Okay.
In a steamer trunk. And it is objects like gold pokes, mining tools, but it is also archives. It is 14 years of documentation dating to the Klondike Gold Rush from the beginning of the Gold Rush. Hilscher worked for George Carmack. He worked the claims for Carmack, and then figured out he wasn't going to make any money, so he came up with his own way of making money off the Gold Rush. And he set up a series of stores between towns and the miners. And he expanded it. So it was just originally just the Klondike Gold Rush area. But then Alaska sort of had a Gold Rush explosion.
Right.
So there was a Gold Rush in Fairbanks, there's Gold Rush in Nome. And he had a series of these stores set up all the way between Fairbanks and Nome. But they weren't grocery stores. They were stores for storing your food for your dogs. So there were warehouses, basically, right, for dog food.
Wow.
Which was helped out the miners and anybody else in Alaska, because your mode of transportation was dog sleds.
Right.
And you didn't have to carry the dog's food as well as all of your food and supplies because you could have it warehoused.
But it was your supply that then you paid him to store, or he provided it and you just bought it from him?
That I haven't figured out yet. But that was kind of cool that,
yeah.
that, you know, you could just go along this trail and
yeah.
you didn't have to carry the dog's food with you.
Right.
The thing I like about the Hillshire collection, though, is he did a series of 15 or 18 books that he wrote on his experiences mm-hmm. in the Gold Rush.
Mm-hmm.
And he researched, he sent notes, letters to other Stampeders that he knew, prospectors, and he said, hey, give me your stories.
Wow.
And so he gathered their stories, and he started writing these books. I am hoping that I'm still curator of record. I still have responsibility to Klondike for, I forget how many days it is, but it's a certain number of days every year. And so I'm hoping to be able to take those books and put them together. So it's not 18 books. It's book one is in this booklet. It's like a composition
mm-hmm.
booklet. And he sent it off to his wife and an editor. And so while that one was gone, he started book two. And he's, you know, sent that one off. And he started book three, and then book one came back. And so he started book four in book one. Oh. They have to piece them all together to get the whole story.
Right.
Right now, they're sitting in a box. They're not accessible. But those stories, 15 yeah. or 18 of them, are extremely valuable to the history of the Klondike Gold Rush.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Yeah, so that's my goal, is to see if we can't get those typed up, transcribed.
Put into order.
Yeah. And that it's what you have to have the whole collection because, you know, book one's in book one, it might be in book six, it might be in book,
right.
you know, 20.
That sounds confusing.
Yeah. But it's a whole series of stories. So that to me is my favorite part of the collection.
Cool.
And then the other part of that is his wife apparently wrote and published a story, but I don't know if it's his story or her story, what it was like being the wife of a Stampeder. She was in like Illinois or Minnesota and he's in Alaska, and then they moved to Seattle. So trying to find that story.
Yeah, that would be really
to make a complete picture.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much has been done on the Stampeders and all that, but you had to hear the side of the wife left behind.
Yep, with the kids and
that would be pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So that her writing is in the collection, or you've just heard about it and you have to...
We have to find it. We're
trying
to track it down. Yeah. So, and hopefully it does. The Hillshire family still lives in the area. So, somebody in the family might have it.
Wow. So, yeah, you're sort of a little bit like a private investigator.
Yeah.
Curatorial yeah. investigator.
It's always a game of Clue.
Yeah.
Put it all together. So that's mine. Obviously, the collections that came in during my tenure are pretty, you know, cool to me.
Yeah.
So we've had jewelry made out of gold nuggets that were mined in the Klondike Gold Rush that came in. Journals from prospectors who went up there. Those are all really cool
mm-hmm.
Things that have come in.
How are decisions made about whether it stays in Seattle or it should go up to the Skagway unit?
It depends. Everything that's come into Seattle, the donors have brought it in and specifically donated it to Seattle. We had one donor who came in who asked if we could send it up to Skagway. So that collection went up there. It was a rifle and some letters that were written on wood
wow.
to children.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've got some dog noise. Let's pause it for a second. Yeah, because I was thinking, like, that Hilscher collection, that sounds like, you know, it's so very much focused on the Alaska part of the story versus the Seattle part.
Your scope of collections tells you what you can and cannot collect, and Klondike Seattle says they can collect about the Klondike Gold Rush as well as Seattle's role in the Klondike Gold Rush. I am guessing that Skagway says they collect about Skagway's involvement in Dawson City, Chilkoot Trail. Right. And probably not Dawson because that's Canada now.
But about the Gold Rush, that the Skagway unit probably doesn't say they can collect about the role of Seattle.
Right, and it won't say that they can collect about any of the sites that are part of Canada.
Right.
So we each have our specific sites.
Yeah.
So.
You've ever felt like there's competition between Skagway and Seattle for collections that are specifically about the Gold Rush, since you kind of have that overlap?
No, not really. It's we leave it up to the donor. We let them know, and if it's something that, when Samantha Reichert was the curator at Skagway, she got a collection in, and she took out of that collection the things that she wanted at Skagway, and she specifically asked the donors, can I share the collection with Seattle? And we do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Or we'll just make the call and say, it's more appropriate for it to be up in Skagway than it is in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
But a certain amount of what we have to do is to tell the Klondike Gold Rush story. So we have to have some items.
Right. And are most collections that Klondike Seattle has, are they from donors? Or how else are collections obtained?
When the collection was first started, it was started by from the Pacific Northwest Regional Office. The interpreter and cultural resource specialist, along with the superintendent that was assigned to both parks, went out and collected objects. And they physically went out into the field and onto the Chilkoot Trail and around the area that was federal land at the time and collected things. So we had, like, folding canvas boats and horseshoe teeth and that sort of thing that were collected specifically for Seattle. And that stuff, for the most part, has been sent back to Skagway over the years. So the rest of the collections are coming in through purchases or through donations, but primarily donations.
Yeah. And so purchases, are those from individual people, or those are somebody sees an item on eBay and then decide they should have it, or how does that work?
Most of the purchases have been not eBay, but places that have repositories that have collections, period pieces.
Mm-hmm.
So antique stores, that sort of thing. And they were purchased specifically for exhibits. So like crosscut saws, mining tools, that sort of thing. We do have a large component of our collections that are on loan to us. There's a lot of assay companies around the area. Because remember, there were no assay offices up in Skagway.
They had to come down here.
So we have on loan to us the scales and the assay tools that were used in the Seattle Assay Office. Which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
They are huge.
Wow.
Scales that came in. And they've got, you know, your little weights and... Of course, they're not little. These ones are big weights, but we also have the smaller ones,
right.
Like the George Carmack. It would be what you would call a pocket scale, but you couldn't fit in your pocket, but it's about this big. And the weights are all the way down to a little tiny.
So is it like 2 feet taller?
Yeah, it's about like this by this.
It's a 4x2, something like that. Yeah. Yeah, which...
And it comes apart, and you know, so they could put it in their bag or whatever.
Right. Well, that's like our old days of what a quote-unquote laptop, a portable computer was.
Yeah,
right? A portable assay set was...
So we have that sort of thing. We have people who have loaned for the exhibits journals and photographs and objects from their ancestors, and then turned around and donated them because they were on exhibit for so long. Right. That they, you know.
That's what I was going to say, is if somebody loans it for an exhibit, do they eventually donate? Or why?
Sometimes.
Why loan versus donate?
Well, at the time, that's what they wanted to do. I mean, that's what's happening with the Seattle Assay Office. It's a private individual family that purchased it. When they closed the assay office, they recognized what it was, and they purchased it. And so, it's... Let's see if I remember this. The husband owned it, and he passed away. So the wife, was in like her 80s or 90s, loaned it. And with the intent that upon her death, it would be donated. And so the children have a trust.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking children who are in their 40s, 50s, 60s, have a trust. And they all know that the collection will, upon her death, be donated to the park.
But she's still alive.
Yeah.
Right. And that, you know, that makes me think about, you know, curatorial work. You guys have to keep track of all those things.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that, how does that knowledge get passed along? I mean, you're curative record, but you're not up there anymore, and what if that situation comes up?
Oh, it's in the acquisition records.
Okay.
That's all the stuff that we keep in the acquisition records, so you can go through it and see. So, like, Taryn knows the loans renew, mm-hmm. so she knows when it renews. And every time that it renews, then we also send the paperwork that says, you know.
Do you still want to renew?
Do you want to renew the loan, or at this point, do you want to transfer it to a, roll it over to a gift?
Right.
So, and we have some who took it back. They have a discussion with their family, and, you know, they discovered that, okay, nobody in the family really is going to take care of it, so then they send it back to us. And we have to then turn it into a gift at that point.
Right.
We have some where they loaned it, and then they loan ended, and they've kept it, and we're hopeful that someday the collections will find its way back either to Seattle or to Skagway. Mm-hmm.
And do you make contact with those people every once in a while to say, hey, are you interested in donating?
I think some curators do.
Mm-hmm.
It's not my thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I will follow up if they've called and said, I want to do this. But I won't hound them. It's just not something I do.
Well, it does sound like curating is, as you say, a lot of organizing, a lot of details, and keeping track and making sure you keep good records.
Yes.
Of everything.
It's a very, very important role. If you don't keep the records, then you end up doing what I'm doing at Mount Rainier, which is the Reconciliation Project. And Mount Rainier has 2.2 million items. And so I have to track down every item and all the paperwork that goes with every item to get it back, cross-reference back together. Because they didn't have a curatorial program until 2005. But they've been in existence since 1899. They've been collecting through like 30 years before that.
Wow.
So somebody was collecting natural history specimens. So we have to make sure we got all the paperwork and all the objects tagged and cross-referenced.
We were talking about, you know, the sharing of collections from Seattle up to Skagway. During your time working with the Seattle Union, how was that collaboration? Is there a lot of collaboration between the two units, or are they
not as much as we'd like? But there's a lot of collaboration with exhibits, particularly since we started the University of Washington Museology Graduate Program.
Do those exhibits ever travel to Skagway?
No, the students do not have the capacity to develop traveling exhibits. We've only, how long has it been going on now? 9 years. In that time, we've done one traveling exhibit, and it hasn't traveled yet. But that was, we own the exhibit designs. So when the students, we give them like three themes. So there's three teams of students, of 4 to 6 students each. So if we select exhibit A to fabricate and install, exhibits B and C designs are at the park, and we can fabricate them and install them on our own. So we chose one, which was the Fisher exhibit, and it was beautifully designed, but the students only had like 16 hours to actually install the exhibit.
Wow.
So because they only have a 2-hour class, 8 weeks, that's it. So we didn't think they could actually get it done in that time because they were hand painting the walls.
Wow.
To make it look like a forest, and they were building this log that visitors could crawl through and see fissures and that sort of thing. So when Taryn came on board, that was one of the exhibits that she was assigned to take and make it happen. And she worked with the students who had since graduated, and they came back, volunteered their time.
Wow.
And they got a bunch of scientific illustrators involved. They had, I'm not kidding you, the community of Seattle was invited to come in and paint the walls.
Wow.
So the scientific illustrators drew it all out, and then the community came and painted it. And it was all overseen by Taryn and the mm-hmm. students. And then they fabricated the logs. And by that time, we actually had fissures. When the students designed it, there were no fissures in any museum collection in the Park Service.
Wow.
But because of this fissure reintroduction program, there's a certain amount of attrition where the specimens are lost. So we were able to put in, I think when the exhibit opened, there was one, no name. That was his name, no name. So he went into the exhibit, and then before the exhibit ended, Karen also was added to it, and she had she has the capability of, you could see her tracking device that's still inside of her.
Wow.
The University of Washington not only has the museology graduate program that helps with the exhibit designs, they also have taxidermy office. So because the specimens belong to Mount Rainier, I was able to get the University of Washington to do the taxidermy on it, and they knew it was going immediately on exhibit at Klondike.
Mm-hmm.
So they worked to get it so that visitors could come in and turn on the tracking different buttons and see all the what was going on.
Cool.
So we made it really hands-on. But she was able to take that exhibit then, which would have been like 3 months, but a lot of work for 3 months. And it was up for, I think, 9 months. And it's in pieces, so it can travel.
Mm-hmm.
But we just haven't found any place in the state of Washington that it can travel to.
I think Olympic Park.
No. The problem with the big parks is they don't have any exhibit space. They have visitor centers.
Right.
But they have permanent exhibits in their visitor centers. No,
they don't,
temporary exhibit rooms.
They don't
rooms.
Have any space for traveling exhibits.
Yeah. So we've thought about Northwest Trek, mm-hmm. who actually collaborated on the whole exhibit.
Which is the park just up the road here.
Yep. It's a little wildlife park up the road. They helped with collaboration, trying to figure out, okay, where do you find fake log debris and stuff.
Right.
So the students don't have the capacity to do the traveling exhibits. But what we do is they will do an exhibit. What did we just do an exhibit on? They borrowed stuff. They did one on photography at the Klondike.
Which is, there's a lot of, it's one of
the presidents of the proclamations and stuff. I can't remember what it was, but basically the students have access to Seattle and Skagway's ICMS. We can show it to them, so they can come into Seattle and look at the...
And ICMS is the cataloging program.
Yeah, so they can go through and look at the catalog records. Skagway has a large portion of theirs photographed,
mm-hmm.
so you can see the data and the image of the item at the same time, and then they will, as part of their exhibit design, they come up with a list of what artifacts that they're interested in mm-hmm. and what graphics they're interested in. And then it's been my role to then contact the museums and repositories that have the graphics and the artifacts. So with Skagway, I just call up Sam, mm-hmm. Or this last time it was Ann, and say the students would like to borrow these artifacts for this exhibit, and it runs from this date to this date, type thing. And they've always... we have discovered that it is cheaper to borrow artifacts from Skagway than it is to borrow artifacts from Lake California. Not because they charge a fee, but just the shipping is cheaper.
From Alaska, that's interesting.
I know. It's more complicated, but it's cheaper.
And now does Skagway, have they borrowed items from Klondike Seattle?
No, not that I'm aware of. They might have when Keith was there, but not since I've been there. And I don't know if they've got more permanent exhibits. We have, because we have a rotating exhibits program, at one point we were tasked with changing the exhibits 4 times a year.
Yeah.
That's a lot of work.
Yeah.
So with Charles now, he's just, whatever works for you guys, he's happy with, but it has to rotate. Mm-hmm. Can't be on exhibit for 2 years in a row, which is what I was finding 2-4 years.
Right. And as you say, in many parks, it's permanent. They put it in once, and maybe they dust it every once in a while.
Well, that's what we have. When you go up to visit Seattle, you'll find the permanent exhibits. They're on the first and second floors. And then there's a 200-square-foot rotating exhibit area by the theater and gift shop. And that's our rotating exhibits. Those rotate every 3 to 6 months, about.
That's a lot of work.
It is a lot of work. That's why the university program works very well, because we're working with the students to develop exhibits. So we can come up with our own exhibits, but we don't have to, because the students have already created mm-hmm. designs. So we can just pull from that.
Right. And what year was that internship program started? Do you remember?
2010. It's not really an internship. We had student interns. The University of Washington Museology program requires all of their students to do internships. Not just one, but like 3 at a time.
Wow.
So they are interning at the Burke Museum. At the same time, they were interning with me at Klondike, and maybe they were at Seattle Art Museum at the same time. So they do 3
wow.
Interns. They're very well trained.
Right. And so the internship was different. This exhibit is part of their coursework.
It's part of their coursework, their exhibit coursework.
Right? And that started around 2010?
That started in 2010, yeah.
Okay. And the internship part was...
I think internship started in 2010, too.
Okay.
So some of the students in the exhibits program also are interested in interning with me,
mm-hmm.
but they also have, it's like a job fair, but it's called an internship fair. And all the museums in the Seattle area, greater Seattle area, are invited, and all of the students in the museology program come in, and you talk one-on-one with the curators of each of these institutions,
mm-hmm.
Find out what is going to be happening in the internship program that year, and you make connections, And then some places will call the students, or some places will rely on the students to then get in contact with them when they're available. So that's been going on since about 2010. There's been a few years where we haven't at Klondike had any interns because the priority was to train Taryn.
Mm-hmm.
She came from a historical society into the Park Service. So I spent 2 or 3 years, might have been 4 years, sending her to Park Service sites.
Mm-hmm.
So she's been to the Channel Islands. She's been to San Francisco Maritime to learn NPS exhibit design.
Okay.
She went to Yosemite to learn archives processing and care. She went up to North Cascades to learn natural history. She went to Evie's Landing, San Juan, to learn archaeology.
Well, it sounds like you experienced this, and now she is, that the Park Service provides a really good training ground.
Yes, yes. They don't have museum methods anymore, so it's now all mentoring.
Mm-hmm.
And so, because I'm a generalist, so I have knowledge, a little bit of knowledge about everything, but I'm not a specialist in anything.
Right.
Except organizing. So the best way for somebody who works for me to learn is for me to send them off to those specialists.
Right. But it's great that the Park Service has those opportunities and is willing to support somebody to move up in their position in their field and learn that stuff.
Right. So Klondike, Seattle now has a very well-trained curator. She's not a full-level curator.
Right.
But she has the ability to do full-level. She's got the skills.
Right. And you learned it, you know, along the way as well.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the other parts of Klondike Seattle and Klondike Skagway work together, cooperate?
You mean interpretation?
Yeah, I mean, were talking
about... That's all we have is interpretation, education. I want to say, keeping in mind here, I only work there every other week.
Right, right.
You know, for 10 years. So, but in my dealings there and the time that was in meetings and stuff, there was always, how do we involve Skagway? I don't know if the same thing was happening on Skagway's side, but I know interpretation and curation have always, in Seattle, have been trying to
mm-hmm.
somehow make that connection, make mm-hmm. it stronger. I know that the administrative history that they want to rewrite. They're trying to Skagway is the one that's initiating
mm-hmm.
A stronger connection on that side. So there is both within the individual divisions and from the superintendent's office, I think on both sides, trying to find a way to strengthen those connections.
Right. Which implies that in the past those connections have not been so strong.
I think when there was a superintendent, one superintendent for both parks, there might have been a stronger connection, but, you know, it would be guesswork on my end.
Right.
I think we realize that we're telling the same story and we have sides of our story that only we can tell and sides of the story that both can tell.
Mm-hmm.
For Seattle, we're trying to also involve Parks Canada. Some of the collections that we have are on loan to us from Parks Canada. So we have a connection with them. And just trying to tell the story of all the parks involved in Klondike.
Yeah, I know on the Skagway end, you know, they're connected with Parks Canada. I mean, the trail management and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But, and you know, the story, they went from Skagway into Canada. But the Seattle part of the story, how does that connect with Canada?
It's the same story, obviously, because they came from Seattle and they
right.
went up to Skagway and then they
okay.
went up to Canada. And just working with them, you know, to borrow artifacts for exhibits and that sort of thing, tell their story down mm-hmm. here and help get visitors up there to find out more. So we're sort of the jumping off part for the Park Service in this area. You want to know about the parks, go to downtown Seattle and they'll tell you all about what's happening in the parks in the area.
So you, like, become a park information service.
Right, right. So, and, which is, you know, it's good. And we do the same for Klondike. You're going up to, we have the ships are here.
Mm-hmm.
So we had it for a long time. A ranger that went on the ships gave a program and introduced them to what they were going to see when they got up to Skagway. And if they were going beyond that to Dawson and that sort of thing. And that was, as far as I know, a very popular program. I want to say, but you'll have to ask Sean to confirm it, I want to say at some point our rangers actually went on the cruise.
Oh.
But I could be wrong.
So yours is that when the crews were docked in Seattle before they left, a ranger would go on and give them a
Yep. The Klondike ranger went on and gave them a lecture, and then they went off to
And they don't do that
Skagway.
Anymore?
I believe they do not do that anymore. I don't know when it ended. I want to say in the last year or two.
Do you know why?
I do not. That would be the superintendent. You need to talk to him.
Sean might know.
No, it was still going on when Sean was
okay.
there. So it ended in Charles's time period. And it may just be, I think it's the cruise ships, that they've just changed directions as to how they want the passengers, and, you know, with security and everything. It's like that. They may not have time anymore.
Yeah. Did you ever get the opportunity to go to Skagway and work with the staff up there?
No, and we're trying to get Taryn up there. So Taryn has been requested to help out with the collection up there, but the project hasn't been funded yet or something like that. So, but yeah, Taryn's very big on, we want to get that connection across.
Do you wish you had the chance to go up?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I guess if you're still officially curator on record, you still could.
Oh, yeah. If there's something really going on, yeah.
You don't get to just go up to just to see it. There has to be a specific project.
Yeah, the government has to be beneficial to both parks and for the government to pay for it.
So. Yeah. I guess if you're an interp ranger, there's an easier justification so you could see what you're explaining down here. Maybe
no. Be the same thing. There really has to be funding for it and some sort of benefit. So the benefit is the same whether it's interpretation or it's curation, and that is to benefit your home park.
Right.
And knowing about what's being interpreted there, what the collections are up there. For Taryn, when we were sending her to the other parks to learn about curation, she was also benefiting that park by having to do a project for them.
Right.
After they trained her.
Like, oh, we need this collection process. That's what you get to do.
Yeah, or she had to create a wayside for San Francisco Maritime.
Mm-hmm.
This would be the same thing. She still does that. That's part of her funding is different parks are hiring Klondike. Her through Klondike to come help them with their collections. And so Skagway has requested it and it's been approved, but it's just, there's no funding. The funding hasn't come through yet.
Right.
So when that does come through, I think that would be good because Taryn has worked, when her position was first established, she did 60% curation and 40% interpretation. So when she goes up there, she's now 100% curation. She will have the background of both divisions going up with her. And so she will not just go up and look at artifacts. She will be looking at their interpretive program and everything else and bringing back that information to benefit the whole park.
Well, it sounds like, you know, your experience doing curation, you learned so much about the history and the stories. I mean, you're almost like the park historian that you know, you do exhibits. You're an interpretive person. You're not just sitting there looking at bags of nails.
Oh, yeah. Debitage. in order to curate or to interpret at any park site, to do any job, whether it could be law enforcement or maintenance, you need to do the research and learn the history of the mm-hmm. parks in order to do a good job. It's kind of it's just part of the job description. You learn about your park. We move around primarily on our own, but particularly with the seasonal, you have to move to get a job.
Right.
So you're learning. It's the first thing, like the first 2 weeks, you're just inundated with history. And then you're developing programs or doing whatever else that you're tasked to do with. And then you move on to another park, and you got to learn it all over again.
Right.
So parks hire, we're given a cert. And, for example, the cert, I just hired the museum tech at Rainier. I had people from Arizona, people from Massachusetts, Florida. I want to say there was somebody from Alaska. And they're not from the Pacific Northwest. They're not from Mount Rainier. Mm-hmm. So I can't expect them to know the history of Mount Rainier. But I can expect them to learn the history of Mount Rainier. And you'll find that park people do that very well.
Mm-hmm.
We that's just the way we are. We know that when we go in, the first thing we have to do is learn the history.
Right.
And then you'll learn the history of the site, then you learn the history of the program that within that site, and then you start your job. So
for Klondike Skagway, did you do a lot of reading of various books, or how do you learn
for
that
Klondike history? Seattle?
Yeah, that's
because I've never been to Skagway.
No, I meant Klondike Seattle.
Yeah, there's a library here in the Pacific Northwest. The curator is also the librarian. it's a tough.
Yeah.
It's two different responsibilities, and you can do things with the library that you cannot do with curation. So it's kind of a tightrope. But in the curator's office is the park library. And there are, like, a whole wall of library books. And then, so when you come on, you get a list of the recommended library books to read. And then when you start doing your programs, if you're an interpreter, just everybody else in that park is interpreters. So they're developing programs and that sort of thing. So they've got their core that they have to read. And then when they figure out what they want to do programs on, then they start reading all these other books. Spend a lot of time reading and researching. We have microfiche, and old newspapers and those sort of things that are microfiche that they use.
I would think the Seattle collection would be a lot of old newspaper stories for people going up to the Klondike or...
Yes, yes. We have the Seattle Times... The Seattle Post-Intelligencer, something like that. I can never say the word. But we have a lot of newspapers that are microfiche. We have reference collections from places we were able to gather Klondike information from, but it's copies. It's not the originals. So there's a little reference collection that staff can go to and do research there. We also have the University of Washington Library Special Collections. They're right down the road. And they have a large Klondike collection.
Hmm.
And a large Historic Seattle collection
that
we can pull from. So they've never denied us loan rights. We just develop an exhibit, send them a list of what artifacts or graphics that we're interested in, and they walk them right over.
And did the ships that people took up to Skagway and Dyea, are there manifests of passengers?
Some of them, yeah.
And that's in the Seattle collection?
We have, I know of at least one. We have a logbook for it, and I think we have a manifest for at least one of the ships. So
those sorts of things have survived.
Yeah. And I'm not sure if UW has more of them.
And of course, some of the ships didn't make it.
Right. Right.
Which is, I guess, part of the story that is told at the Seattle Union, is the ships and...
Well, there's... Yeah, we'll tell anything that has to do with, like, building the ships, because it was huge. The money coming back, what the money was used for, how Seattle was built using that money. So Seattle is a lot higher in elevation than it was before the gold rush, and has a lot more buildings. Yeah, they raised the streets.
Yeah, I know there's that old, you can take that underground tour.
Yeah.
And I've never understood how that happened, that there's a whole sort of city underneath a city.
Yeah, they raised it. That's the same with the Cadillac Hotel, where Klondike Seattle is.
Mm-hmm.
The basement was really the first floor, but it's underground.
Yeah, this doesn't make sense.
Yeah. So I don't know. You have to ask somebody. I've never been on the underground tour, so
yeah,
I don't know why.
I was on it when I was like 12, so yeah. I don't quite remember the details.
So I don't remember why, but somebody decided we needed to raise the streets. But see, the gold came back to Seattle, and hotels were built quickly to house stampeders and get them on their way. There was a competition between Seattle and several other coastal towns to outfit the stampeders. And so Seattle was successful in drawing stampeders, prospectors.
Versus coming from San Francisco, for instance.
Yeah, don't get your stuff in San Francisco. Wait till you get to Seattle. Then, you know, instead of having to carry it all up to Seattle, which is the jumping off point.
Right.
You know, that's where you had to come to go.
Yeah, the ships from San Francisco stopped in Seattle anyway? Or did they just go straight?
I don't know. I just know that a lot of them were built here and left from here.
Well, it adds to the side story of the gold rush. There were the stampeders who staked claims and may or may not have found gold. And then there's all those people who made money off of that.
Right.
With hotels and...
Right. Most of the gold was made before news of the gold rush even made its way down to the lower 48. But Hilscher is a good example of somebody who made his fortune off of the gold rush, off the prospectors.
Right.
Soapy Smith is another
right
good one.
But you say building a hotel down here...
Yep.
You made money off of them down here.
Yeah,
you didn't
yeah
have to go to the Chilkoot Trail to make your money.
No. Well, we've got pictures of, like, Cooper and Levy. They were suppliers, outfitters. And there's just supplies out into the street that were stocked full, you know, floor to ceiling. And they had to go outside to keep their supplies, you know, enough supplies in stock.
Wow.
And part of that was because they were required to carry a ton of... And
right.
We've wrestled with that. Were they really required to take a ton of goods up? And I think they came down to, yeah, they were. Somebody came across something that said that they were by the Royal Mounted Police.
Right.
So... You couldn't get a ton of goods in Skagway,
no,
so you had to take it with you. And Seattle capitalized on that.
And that must have cost a fortune. The reason you were going to the Klondike was to get rich, supposedly.
Right.
But to get there, you had to have money to outfit yourself.
Exactly.
And I don't know how those guys did it. Your dogs are getting impatient.
It's just her. and what I find interesting is some of the stuff that was taken. I mean, we have pictures of them hauling a piano. It's like, you got people dying on that trail, horses dying on that trail, and you're hauling a piano up it.
unless you think you're going to open a saloon somewhere along the way.
Yep.
And then you need a piano.
Yeah.
Maybe that was it, but...
I think that in that particular picture it was, that it was...
But it does look pretty ridiculous when you see them carrying all that stuff. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But, you know, there were towns that were popping up.
Mm-hmm.
So, and before the Klondike Gold Rush, at least Seattle, I don't know if the rest of the country was, but Seattle was in a depression. They'd had the Great Fire, and the depression hit. So the Klondike Gold Rush was an infusion of money, a lot of money all at once. And they did well with it. I mean, that's where we got all our buildings. And,
right.
That's why we're in the Cadillac Hotel. It was built with Klondike Gold Rush money.
Yeah.
And how, you know.
And that Pioneer Square part of town was sort of the jumping off point.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's where the boat building is. It's where all of your suppliers were, your outfitters.
Mm-hmm.
It's now, it's historic part of Seattle. It's not as built up, but you can walk around Pioneer Square and you can see the names of the old buildings still on the bricks that are still there. They're brick buildings, so they're still standing. They had an earthquake in, Squally earthquake of 2001 or 3. I think it was 2003. That collapsed a lot of the buildings in Pioneer Square.
Yeah.
But they've all been, for the most part, rebuilt. All the bricks that came down, they put them right back up.
So did the Cadillac Hotel suffer during that earthquake?
Yes, Cadillac Hotel had to be completely rebuilt, except for the bottom floor. All the buildings that were rebuilt to be earthquake proof. And they kept it to, the exterior is historic, the way it looked historically. The interior, there are historic features in there. So like where our offices are on the third floor, you can tell it was a hotel. But the first and second floor are exhibits. The third floor offices. So the third and fourth floor, actually, you can kind of tell that it was a hotel. And they have, like, the hotel numbers, room numbers, that sort of thing. But they're all offices. And then the first and second floor, which is really the basement and the first floor, the basement was a speakeasy. It's now collection storage and exhibits and classrooms. And then the main floor, which is now the second floor, is exhibits and theater and gift shop. But they tried to keep historic pieces, components there, but while adapting the building.
So that earthquake, did that affect the collections and were things damaged?
The collections were not in the Cadillac Hotel. We did not have the Cadillac Hotel at the time. It's on lease to us. So, when the, Nisqually earthquake hit, the building was owned privately and they didn't have the funds to, rebuild it. So Historic Seattle stepped in and they purchased it and then, they purchased it knowing that they wanted to, lease it to the National Park Service as a permanent home for the Klondike Seattle unit. We were in the Union Trust building prior to that, and which was jigsawed down about a block and a half. But that was a lease with no real... There was no Klondike connection. So the Cadillac Hotel has a Klondike connection. It's built with Klondike money. It has housed prospectors going to the Klondike. So the Park Service, through the Government Services Administration, leased the building with rights to purchase it I think it's like 40 years, within 40 years. So, Charles will know the exact date.
But so that earthquake didn't cause any damage to park collections or exhibits or anything?
Not the Union Trust building, no.
Okay.
So, I don't think the Union Trust building was damaged at all.
No valuable artifact fell off a shelf in the earthquake.
Mm-mm, no,
wow, that's good.
It's just more of a not modern building, so not as modern as current buildings. But yeah, as far as I know, nothing.
That's good.
So that would be a question for Keith. but I haven't seen any records in the acquisition files that said it was lost due to damage from the earthquake.
And so the two units, Skagway and Seattle, being under one superintendent and one administration, that was before you were involved.
That was when it was first started.
Right.
And then after that superintendent, I believe all the following superintendents were individual parks. So I think it was difficult across regions because even though we all report to Washington, we also have to report to our region. And so if you're working two regions, you've got two different bosses telling you what to do.
As a superintendent, yeah.
So for management, it's easier to have them separate.
And in terms of at the staff level, do you think it would matter whether you reported to a superintendent in Seattle versus one in Skagway?
Well, if you're at Skagway, you'd want to report to the one in Skagway. Because it'd be really hard to be working in Skagway but have your boss in Seattle.
Well, I was thinking of here in Seattle the other way around, too.
Yeah.
So even from a staff side, it makes more sense.
Because we have, well, you have the parks work plan. You have the region's work plan. You have the network's work plan. You have the Washington work plan. So then if you're working here, but your boss is over in this group, they have a whole different
agenda for you.
Right. Yeah. They have their own, what do we need to do? But it's good to collaborate, and that's what we're trying to do is set up that collaboration and make it stronger. It's reality is funding. We do what we can.
And so when you came on as curator of record, what was sort of the condition of the collections at Klondike, because it sort of had been collateral work by Interp staff and rangers.
Right. So the ranger, Keith, was a ranger, but he had a museology background. It was actually mostly just catching up on accessioning and cataloging, which is why I was able to free time to start developing exhibits and that sort of thing. They were pretty well cataloged. There's a small backlog. Klondike Seattle has one of the most cataloged collection percentage-wise. Their collection is more cataloged than most of the parks.
And why do you think that is?
Well, partially because of Keith. And then he paved the way, so it was easy to just keep up on stuff that was coming in. And then the regional curators at the time were funding backlog cataloging projects, so we were able to hire people to come in and get those cataloged. Yeah.
That does seem unusual.
Yeah. So I can't say that at Rainier. I can say that the insects are cataloged.
Well, and it may be as you that you know Klondike, Seattle being a smaller park and a smaller collections, maybe it's easier to catch up on the backlog. I don't know.
Yes and no. I think the concern now is we've caught up on the backlog. We don't have a real backlog. I mean, it might be from year to year, and that's it. But we have a huge partnership program and exhibits program now that we could create a backlog by dealing with these areas and forgetting about this area. So that's the concern now, and that's part of, as curator record, that's part of what I will be driving, is, hey, have you done your cataloging this year?
Yeah, don't forget that part.
Yeah, yeah, registration is the key. If you don't do registration, then your collection's history is lost.
You don't know what you have.
Yeah, yeah. So,
So, while you were doing work in Seattle, it was Karen and Jacqueline were the superintendents?
Karen, then Jacqueline, and now Charles.
Right. Yeah. So, you talk about them, I mean, in terms of as superintendents and working with them, and...
They were, all three of them were really good. The superintendents that I worked under before have had limited curation experience, limited cultural resource experience. So working with Karen and Jacqueline and Charles has been fantastic because they have some cultural experience and they're very interested in the collections and recognize the fact that without the collections, they don't really have anything to interpret.
Mm-hmm.
They can interpret the story, but they don't have anything to support that story if they're not taking care of the collections. Yeah, it actually was really nice working with them because they understood and they wanted to learn what it is that the curator does, what the collections contain, what their responsibilities are.
We may have maxed out the dog patience. I'll pause for a second.
Jacqueline. Admitted.
Well, I was also thinking about sort of their management styles.
Sort of. They're not. None of them are micromanagers. They're not, you know, breathing down your neck. They recognize that they've hired professionals. And let the professionals do the jobs, but they want to know what it is that you're doing, which is refreshing because most of the superintendents I worked under don't have a clue what I do.
Mm-hmm.
Not even my supervisor has a clue what I do. So it was refreshing to have them say, hey, what do you do? How do we help? What's our responsibility to this? I think the biggest thing was they didn't want to make mistakes. And there'll always be mistakes, but they didn't want to make a mistake. So they would call and ask the questions. So even though I'm down here at Rainier, I would get phone calls and emails.
Mm-hmm.
This person wants to do this. Can I let them in the collections? And so they recognize that you can't just open the collections door and let people in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, somebody's got to be responsible for that. And they realize... Ultimately, they're the responsible one. If something walks out, they're responsible for it. So they always will call or email. They still do it, you know.
And from your experience in other parks with superintendents, that's unusual.
Yeah, yeah. They don't get the connection there. Some of them do.
And again, I wonder if that's just because Klondike Seattle is small and its focus is so specific, telling a story. It's not like, oh, we have this big mountain to look at, or...
Well, it's Klondike has one resource.
Right.
And that's the collections.
Right.
Whereas Rainier has the plants, the animals, the history of the park, the glaciers, geology.
Right.
You've got lots of resources. And those are resources that visitors see, that interact. I mean, when the mountain floods as a lahar, that's a big resource that you have to deal with.
Right.
Collections don't say anything.
Right.
They just sort of sit there and slowly deteriorate. They don't scream as loudly.
Right.
So the superintendents of big parks don't have to, you know, they can go their entire career without interacting with the collections at all. But Klondike is established specifically because of those artifacts, and that's different than other parks.
Right.
So it the superintendents from my tenure at Klondike have recognized that fact that their resource is the collections, and they've also realized that now that they're in the Cadillac Hotel, that's also a resource. We don't own that resource, but we plan on owning that resource, so they're now connecting those two.
Right. And that's like what they've done in Skagway with the historic building restoration and leaseback program. Those buildings are a resource.
Exactly.
They are part of the collection.
Right. So, and then starting with Karen and working through Jacqueline and Charles, they started to see, okay, well, what else is there? What other resources are out there? Which is why we now do Historic Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Wing Luke and Bainbridge are partnerships, basically, where they have a story to tell. It isn't Klondike. It isn't Historic Seattle, but it is a story mm-hmm. that nobody else is telling that needs to be preserved.
Right.
So we've expanded what it is we do. And
that sounds like they understand that those are important stories, and being in downtown Seattle is a venue for maybe a larger visitorship than right. out on Bainbridge or
exactly
in Idaho.
And that's why we now, too, we have two programs. We've got the outreach program for letting visitors know about what's happening in the Washington parks.
Mm-hmm.
So you big parks, actually all the parks in Washington. So you've got that. We do that through exhibits. We do it through our websites, that sort of thing, social media. But we also have ORIC, which is the Outdoor Recreation Information Center,
mm-hmm.
which is a collaboration with the Forest Service, the State Parks, the Park Service, and it's housed in REI,
mm-hmm.
right smack in the middle of REI, where people who are interested in going to visit recreational facilities, sites and stuff, they go there to get their camping gear and everything, and here's this visitor information center right in the middle of it that will give you information about North Cascades. It'll give you information about one of the state parks.
That's great.
Forest Service sites. So you're getting information about them, what's happening in those parks. And then they're also being directed for history information to go down to Klondike, Seattle,
yeah.
and see the exhibits and learn about what's yeah. going on in those parks.
Sort of like in Anchorage and Fairbanks, we have Alaska Public Land Information Centers,
mm-hmm.
which are a similar concept, that it's a one-stop shopping to find out about everything
right.
federal lands related. And they may provide state park information too, I don't know. But it's not an REI, but it's the same concept. It's a place people can come to and get what they need in one place.
Right. So all of that's coming out of mm-hmm. Klondike, Seattle.
And that web, didn't you have like a history website or something? What is that called?
I have no idea.
History Link.
Oh, that's Park Service.
Yeah. It's a Park Service-wide thing? And is Klondike, Seattle somehow connected into that? Do you know?
I'm going to say yes.
But because you don't know about it.
I don't okay. know. I mean, I know that Rainier is, but I have nothing to do with it.
Okay. I thought as curator you maybe knew something by giving materials to it or something.
History Link at some point, I'm going to say in the late 1990s, early 2000s, were scanning a lot of historical mm-hmm. documents and things. So, for example, there's a series of documents called nature notes, which were written by park naturalists from about 1922 to the 1980s. And they digitized a lot of those for the for mm-hmm. parks. So, like, all of Rainier's have been digitized, Yosemite, Yellowstone's. So that's what HistoryLink is. You can go to HistoryLink, and it has these digitized nature notes. I know, like, Yellowstone has a bunch of things that were digitized, so we know you can just go there and learn the history of the park through there. But that was a historian program, park historian mm-hmm. program, not a park curator program.
Okay.
So from the park curator point of view, we would have provided them with access to photographs and to the documents. But it's not our program.
Okay. Now, we were talking before about how a curator, you know, an interp staff working together to do exhibits. If you were in a park where there was a historian, what would that collaboration be like with a curator? Is there one?
It depends on what the historian is doing. When I worked at Boston, the regional office, the regional office's museum program was in Boston National Historical Park. They were in one of our buildings, and the regional historian was in that building as well. So his role was to help the parks with their history. So there's a regional historian who then does all this research mm-hmm. On the history of the parks, and he hires people in and that sort of thing. So for Boston, was it Boston? No, it was when they were at Boston, but I was at Acadia. So we hired the regional historian, the regional archivist, and object specialists, and then they hired specific people to come in and help. But we had a military base that was decommissioned while I was at Acadia, and it was literally, Acadia's like this, and there's a donut hole in the middle of it that mm-hmm. was owned by the Navy.
Oh.
And that was decommissioned. It was a base, secret base within the national park. And when it was decommissioned, we have to tell the story because it's part of the park.
Right.
And so the historian, regional historian, is the one that coordinated who got hired. We were hiring object specialists, military object specialists, uh-huh. who understood what these objects were and what was important about them to preserve them. So I know nothing about military history, so that's what we did. We hired somebody who did, who could come in and say, well, that object does this, and it connects to this specific story that's unique to this base. Or, no, you know, all military bases have this, so it's not unique to the story.
Okay.
So they're able to tell us what should be preserved and what should... and then, at that point, then we take it and... We either bring conservators, or if you already know how to preserve it, because it's like all the other objects,
right.
then you go on. But, yeah.
Well, that's,
so we will collaborate. I mean, I collaborate with Harper's Ferry Center conservators, with conservators at Lowell, Massachusetts, collaborate with the what's called ETEC, which is the Electronic Technical Information Center, to get... maps and drawings and documents digitized. So
I guess that's the benefit of being in the Park Service. You have this whole network of expertise that you
right.
can plug right. into.
Right. So you don't. Not everybody has to be a specialist, but we have because we have access to specialists, and that's helpful. Very helpful. It allows us to do that. So, you know. Even though the curator at Klondike isn't a full-fledged curator, or GS-11 is a full-fledged, she has access to a regional curator in Seattle. She has access to myself at Mount Rainier. She can call Olympic. She can call North Cascade. She can call Fort Vancouver.
Right.
She can call anybody for assistance. If she needs conservation, she calls Harper's Ferry. They tell her who out here can do the work, or they'll do it for us.
Is there a time lag in that stuff? I mean, it sounds all nice and good.
Oh, yeah,
we just call somebody in. But are there funding issues involved? Or
there can be. I mean, right now I'm working on one involving fireplace screens. And for us, the time lag is the conditions of the mountain, because we couldn't get to the items to photograph them, to send them off. But then it's also finding the funding to do the conservation work.
Right. So even if you call Harper's Ferry and ask for somebody to help you, you have to have the money at your park to pay for it?
Yes, because they're all project funded. So they're not base funded. Parks
right.
are base funded, and service centers are project funded.
Okay.
So, but if it's an emergency, you know, it's...
Well, it's funding and or they're already working on other things and you have to get in line.
Yeah, there's that. Right. So, but that's okay. I mean, out there it was really easy because the conservators were in Boston and then they moved to Lowell. So when I was in Boston, I just walk in the office and say, hey, guys, I've got this. What do I do with it?
Right.
And they could tell me, or they would teach me to do it while they were working on something else. I'd learn how to do it, and then I could go back and do it. But that's a rarity. They can do that in Lowell. They can do that in at Harper's Ferry, West Virginia, any of the parks there. But what they will do is we had a painting that was donated to us. It was a series of paintings. There's like 27 of them. But the first one the guy ever painted had a hole in it.
Uh-oh.
And then some sort of, like, something had been laid against it. So there was a streak. So instead of it being sent back to Harper's Ferry or to Lowell, they said, you know, such and such is a paintings conservator. Deals specifically with oil paintings located in Bellevue.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have the they can do it themselves, or they know the resources. It's the same with, I'm doing nitrate motion picture film.
Oh, that's bad
so
news.
I called Harper's Ferry and they said, well, you need to call Monique at Northeast Document Conservation Center in Lowell. Talk to Monique. And Monique was saying, okay, well, these are the contacts I have that I know of in your area that can deal with that.
Right. Because it's highly flammable, is my recollection of nitrate film, right?
Spontaneously combusts.
Yes.
Yeah. So having those resources to be able to talk to the people and figure out what to do you're not a museum isolated by yourself. You know, when I was at Acadia, we had 20 museums on Mount Desert Island.
Wow.
Yeah. So we formed a group. IMES. I can't remember what it's Island Museum Associates. Something like that. Island Museum Association. And no, Island Museums and Historical Societies. But of those, there were... I think three or four that had museum staff that were professional museum staff on them. So we formed this organization where the historical societies and the smaller museums could contact us.
Yeah.
And we would hold training workshops, or we'd help them out with a collection they'd just gotten, how to take care of it. And that resource is still going on. They still do that. And it's taken collections from being, like, photographs push-pinned onto the wall to actually being framed and hung on the wall and out of direct sunlight, that sort of thing. And that's what the Park Service, with its service centers, do for all of us.
Right. So the technical assistance programs.
Right.
I know they do that with historical architecture stuff.
Yeah.
They'll do that for private owners in a region. With the work you did in Klondike, Seattle, is there anything that you can look back on as was a particular success that you dealt with? Or something you're most proud of that you contributed?
That's what you're talking about. Well, I would say the University of Washington, collaboration with the University of Washington Museology Graduate Program is a success. It's one that other parks are looking at and have called us on. Like, how did you get this going, and what are the rules?
And you were a key part of that development.
I was the liaison for the whole thing. So what we've done is I have wrote an MOU, a Memorandum of Agreement, between the university and the park. It establishes that the university provides the students and the expertise to teach the students. The park provides the funding and the themes and the venue for the exhibits. It's been a great working relationship. The students that have come out of that program, I can honestly say they've come out of the program. They come out of there. They've interned with me. They're working at places like the Air and Space Museum and the Smithsonian. They're professors of museology.
Great.
And the Department of Defense, they're coming out and they're getting jobs, high-level jobs, from the beginning, from the get-go, and not having to do the schlep work.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I think, is a good outcome of the relationship there. The other one is obviously taking the program, the curatorial program, from being an other duty as assigned to being the primary resource of the park. And it's acknowledged by everybody that it's the primary resource of the park. And they've acknowledged it by finding the funds to hire a museum curator. So the only reason I'm still connected, it was supposed to be a clean break, is because they didn't have the funds to hire as a GS-11.
Right, so you're sort of there as a mentor still.
Right.
Help tearing along.
Technical supervisor. I don't supervise her. I just provide technical information. Mm-hmm. And that's because HR required it.
Yeah.
Which is not to say that I want to be separated from them. I absolutely loved working there. It's for 10 years, every other week. Hopped on a train, went to Seattle. It's a stress reliever, basically. It's totally different than Mount Rainier. Totally different program, totally different staff, policies, directions, how it's managed. There it was teamwork, because it's so small, you had to interact with everybody. So you learned not only your job, but everybody else's job and how it all played together. Loved working there. Sad that I'm not there anymore, but, you know, I am there. I get calls and emails every day.
Yeah, you're still connected.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny that it's nice that it turned out for the best for you, considering you didn't have a say in it at the beginning.
Right. I mean, I actually, when I saw that list, was like, can't really? You couldn't have given me Hawaii? Why are you sending Gay?
But you say it sounds like you've enjoyed having that connection with the Seattle unit.
Yes, I do. A lot.
And it sounds like you're enthusiastic about the stories that are being told there, and you've kind of gotten into the Klondike history part.
Yeah. History, like you say, I have a degree in resource management through forestry and zoology, so history was not where I was going.
Yeah.
But, you know, you get tasked with packing up Abraham Lincoln's things, and history suddenly becomes important.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I went from Abraham Lincoln's stuff to Revolutionary War. Yeah, and World War II is mostly what Boston's about. And then up to Acadia, and suddenly I'm back in 1596 with King Henry IV. So, history's played a huge role in my career.
And with the Klondike Seattle stuff, you just talked about some of the successes that you're proud of. What about particular challenges or obstacles you faced?
Challenges. I think, well, we're working on a reconciliation project right now. The collections that were collected in the beginning of the park's history were returned to Skagway because somebody who had collateral duty thought that the new law that went into place meant that we couldn't have them legally. So they had to be returned to the state of Alaska because the state of Alaska at some point in time in the 90s, I think, declared that they owned everything that was laying around Alaska. Somebody interpreted that as, well, it can't be here in Seattle. It has to go back to Alaska. And Alaska said, well, give it back to Skagway. And it's like, they didn't go through or didn't understand that they had to go through the paperwork to see that there was a legal document in there that said that we had the legal right to have it in Seattle, that was specifically collected for Seattle. So that's frustrating, having to go through and go through that paperwork and close those out.
So are those collections coming back here?
No, they're up on there? They're on exhibit at Skagway right now. So they will stay there. The decision on our end, without talking with Skagway, the decision on our end is they're at Skagway. They're being taken care of. If we need them for an exhibit, we can call them and borrow them.
But so you reconcile the paperwork so they become officially part of the Skagway collection?
Mm-hmm.
Is that?
Yeah. Yeah. So we have to do a deaccession on our end.
Right.
Officially deaccession on our end. They've officially accessioned them on their end. But we'll deaccession on our end, and they'll get copies of all that paperwork saying that we no longer legally claiming these objects.
Yeah, that sounds like a big project.
It is a big project, but something needs to be done. And when you change hands, curators, the outgoing curator should leave the collections in better condition than they received it in, and the new curator should immediately do 100% inventory. So with the transition from myself to Taryn being officially the hands-on person, we're doing a reconciliation to close out all of the other previous people who were taking care of it who were not curators. Close out all of the issues with those collections into 100% inventory so that Taryn has, by the end of her first year as curator, has a complete understanding of what is in the collection and where the legal paperwork stands on all of it. So she'll be able to then know what it'll do is it'll help her to know where the gaps are in the collection and what she needs to seek out. Somebody walks through the door with something, she can say, no, I have 20 of those. Maybe she'd go to Skagway or Dawson or, you know, one of the other sites.
And now, when you were doing the work in Seattle on a more regular basis, is there something that you wished you could have done that you didn't get the opportunity to do with the collections?
Yes. I spent a lot of time in meetings. And so even though the superintendents all were interested in what I was doing and understood that I needed to do this, I kept getting called into meetings. So Charles has made it his policy that I don't come up there and attend meetings. I come up there to do work.
Right.
I don't consider meetings work. They're important, but it's not what I was hired to do for them.
Right.
So at least at that time period. So he always made it a point that if he had needed me for a meeting, he either did a conference call or he made a specific date for me to come up to do meetings. When I was there on my Klondike days, I did the registration work that needed to be done or the exhibit work that needed to be done. So that was good. But to answer your question, the thing that I would have liked to have been able to do is get those Hillshire books transcribed.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still going to talk to Charles about it and We're going to see if we can't move forward on that.
Yeah, it sounds like a great project.
I think it would be beneficial to all of Skagway, or not Skagway, Klondike, so all the Klondike sites. I do not understand why we are not calling ourselves Klondike Gold Rush National, International Historical Park. That's what we are.
Yeah, because they I don't remember what year it was, they made it...
Clinton administration.
Yeah.
Declared it an international park.
In the
park.
90s, I think. Yeah.
So the name should have changed, and maybe it's because I worked at St. Croix Island International Historic Site. I understand the importance of the name.
Yeah, I don't know.
Makes it bigger than it is.
Yeah. What does it encompass on the Canadian side? Is there a Canadian... Is there a Canadian Klondike Historical Park?
Yeah, there's... on the Canadian side, they actually call themselves Klondike Gold Rush International Historical Park.
Oh.
Yes. And it includes Dawson. It includes, I'm going to say it wrong, 20 Mile, 5 Mile, 10 Mile? One of those sites.
I don't know.
I can look it up, but you can look it up. There's like five sites. There's Seattle, Skagway, and three Canadian parks that make up Klondike.
Well, I know the part of the Chilkoot Trail goes through the Canadian side, but I don't know if that's officially in a Canadian national park.
It's part of the system, but it's not. It's managed by Skagway.
And then there's the White Pass unit, but that's Skagway. That's from Skagway.
Yeah, so there's three separate parks in Canada that are Klondike Gold Rush.
That make up that international component. Oh, okay.
And then our two sites, Seattle and Skagway, and the components within
Wrangell National, Wrangell St. Elias, I think, also now has an international component.
Yeah.
And they don't call themselves an international park.
And it's this side of the coast, because the East Coast, you're international, it's big. It's a big deal. And it's because you're no longer just the United States.
Yeah.
You're now...
Right, that's the whole idea.
Part
of
the world.
It's that idea of getting that designation is to bring everybody together.
Yeah. So that I would have liked in my tenure to see them actually recognize that the importance of it. How do I say it? So, for example, if you start out as a national monument, you dream of someday getting a national park status, because a national monument can be. Is managed by whomever owns the land at the time. So, like, Mount St. Helens is a national monument. It's not part of the National Park Service because it's managed by the Forest Service.
Right.
At the time that it became a national monument, it was Forest Service. So, it's still Forest Service.
Oh.
Okay? So, if I'm Mount St. Helens and I want to change how the management of things are done, stop clear cutting, for example, then I want national park status. So I want to go from national monument to national park, or national historical site, or historical park, one of those statuses, where you're under the umbrella of National Park Service. But then you want to go from, actually, Acadia is a good example. Acadia was Sir de Monts National Monument. In 1916, when it was established, it was a national monument. In 1919, it became Lafayette National Park. So it went up. Okay. Then it acquired management of St. Croix Island. Well, St. Croix Island went from a historic, I think just a historic site. I don't think it was a monument. But it went from a historic site to an international site. So collaborating now with Canada to manage that site and the collections on that site and all that. So you're moving up. You start as a national monument, suddenly you're an international site.
Right.
You've moved up. And it's recognizing that you've moved up. You're no longer a single site, an island to yourself. You're now collaborating with partners. Across boundaries that man has drawn, and we're saying those boundaries don't exist.
Yeah, and
This is a story bigger than creative boundaries.
An international park implies you are of a more global importance of a story.
Right, right. Those little lines, it's sort of like the animals. They don't know that there's a line drawn there. So the lines disappear.
Yeah.
And I think that we need to focus on that international relationship. There's a lot to tell. I mean, it was only 3 years.
Yeah.
But it's a huge story.
It is. So. And there must have been Canadian stampeders.
Oh, sure.
You know, but we don't hear about them. All of ours are, you know, they came from Seattle to Skagway and up. You know, what about the people who came in from Canada? Did people come all the way across Canada to go to Dawson? And
well, the natives.
No, I know, but I mean, were there Gold Rush stampeders?
Yeah, they came through Canada probably, yeah.
Yeah, but there you go. You could tell that story. We don't know, as Americans, we don't know that story. Maybe they tell that story in Dawson, I can't remember.
Well, I know that Dawson had a lot of Americans in it, so.
Yeah.
But it is a global story. I mean,
yeah.
What happened to Seattle, it went from a depressed area to it's now huge. It's
hub, yeah.
Yeah, it's a huge hub. Sort of happened in Skagway and Dawson, and where it was big for a few years, and then it dwindled.
Right.
Because gold was found other places, or it ran out. But the effects of it, like Seattle, are still going on.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's the Europeans, white man, or the natives. The effects of that Klondike Gold Rush are still happening.
Yeah. Well, and it is
interesting. The money's still around. I mean, in Seattle, that's one of the exhibits that we did was, where's the Klondike Gold Rush now? In Seattle, where is it? Where are these businesses that were created during the Gold Rush, where are they now?
Hmm.
And you're looking at Nordstrom's. Still exist.
And that was
Filson's still exist.
And they were outfitters.
Yep. Yeah, or they were stampeders, and they came back and started a business. There's a funeral home, actually. I remember that because that's the angle that the exhibit class took was, hey, there's a funeral home that still exists from the Klondike Gold Rush.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Well, and it is interesting to say that Seattle benefited from the gold coming back and developed into a big city, whereas Skagway and Dyea especially, it died out as soon as the White Pass, the train route, was put in. You know, Skagway didn't become a huge metropolis. And that'd be interesting why, but maybe Seattle was already on its way that way.
I think Seattle was on its way that way, which is why they were able to capitalize on the opportunity. But Skagway is capitalizing on the tourism.
Right. Yep, it's their second gold rush.
Yeah, yeah. So everybody does something different. That was one of the things that I was talking to somebody is, there's nobody in this area that's capitalizing on the fact that they live and work at the base of a national park.
Mm-hmm.
But I came from a park that's surrounded by businesses that capitalize on the fact that they're next to a national park.
Right.
So it's totally opposites.
Yeah. So Eatonville is the closest town to Rainier?
Well, you have to go through Eatonville to get to Mount Rainier if you're coming from this direction.
Mm-hmm.
So there's Eatonville, there's Ashford, is right at the base.
Okay.
Packwood's right at the base. But Morton's, you have to go through Morton to get to Packwood or to Ashford. Where you go on the other side, you have to go through Enumclaw and you have to go through Greenwater to get to.
And they haven't capitalized like at Acadia.
None of them have capitalized on it, which is totally foreign to me.
Yeah.
But they haven't. you cannot find a Mount Rainier souvenir without getting on top of Mount Rainier. You might find something like the Space Needle.
Well, you say everybody's different and it's their things. Well, were there any other things that you had in mind to talk about when I approached you with this idea of doing an interview?
Not really. I did go through the collections to see what the collections were.
Oh, okay.
It stood out. So, like, the Hillshire, we talked about. 14 years of being... He was at the Gold Rush, worked for George Carmack, but then spent the majority of his time building up stores to move, make it easier to do your transporting of dog food. And then wrote his own story and collected the stories of Stampeders. The gold scales. We have a lot of gold scales. We have George Carmack's. We have Seattle Assay Office. And then we have assay tools, crucibles and molds and tongs, that sort of thing. That all have to do with what happened to the gold after they dug it out of the ground. One of the interesting collections that we have is a patent and the company's sleeping bag that was created by Sarah Winters, a woman. So they were created for the Klondike Gold Rush, and we have the sleeping bag that she created and the patent that goes with it.
The patent or the pattern? The patent. Because she registered it.
She registered it, right.
So I thought you said patent, and then I wasn't sure.
Yeah, patent. So we have log books and diaries, so like the steamship Willamette, Robert Moran's voyage from Seattle to St. Michael's, Will Wooten and Samuel Goodwin's diaries. We have a collection, a photographic collection by Joe Williamson, which I'd never heard of, but apparently he was taking photographs of the Klondike Gold Rush, which is cool. We have access to, and I just digitized, one of the collaborations as curator of Mount Rainier and Klondike have been able to collaborate. So my volunteer who's digitizing Mount Rainier's collection is also digitizing Klondike's collection for us. And we have Kinsey Photo Studios, who are up in Skagway. Their grandson lives in Seattle. And so he loaned us the Kinsey photographs, and we just digitized those.
Cool.
So there's a lot of pictures of Ron as a boy. We digitized that, and then there's a new collection, and Taryn would know what it is. It had just came in at the end of last summer, and we had it digitized. I think it's called Atwood, and it's got some great photographs in it. And then we have rare books and newspapers. That's what we have. Dog sets, gold jewelry, children's toys from the Klondike Gold Rush.
Huh.
Have you ever heard of the Klondike babies?
No.
Charles Ingalls family, first white babies. I hate to use the word white.
Non-native
babies born in the Klondike are the Ingalls children. And these are their toys that were either created for them or they're all created.
Now, was that somebody that he was like a storekeeper in Skagway, or he was on the trail and took his family with him?
He was a prospector, yeah.
And he took his family with him?
Took his family with him.
Holy cow.
So we have, they're not toys that you would think of, but they are toys that the natives were using. So they're fishing lures, and they're, it's like a kayak, but it's not a kayak.
A boat of some kind?
Yep, that the kids were playing with, and all kinds of toys that
made, like hand-carved out of wood and things like that?
Cool. So those are kind of fun.
Yeah, because you don't think about families
No, you don't. Not in the Klondike.
On the Klondike.
And we had the newspaper clippings and articles and stuff that the family brought with the toys. The Alaska Yukon Pioneer Exposition, the World's Fair, mm-hmm. was held in Seattle in 1910. So we have a lot of memorabilia from that. And I already told you that we have Nordstrom, Filson, mm-hmm. Bartell Drugs. Those are all Klondike gold or businesses. So they either were founded by the gold or they outfitted to mm-hmm. go to the gold. And then we have a collection that is documents, photographs, some objects of pioneers. So there's the Alaska Yukon Pioneers, the Ladies of the Golden North,
mm-hmm.
the Yukoners, the Sourdoughers. We have a collection that we received from them. They disbanded. They were individual organizations. Then they banded together as one organization. Mm-hmm. Then they split up again. And in the end, I think 2008... I think was the last time they ever met.
Well, we in Alaska, we still have a Pioneers of Alaska organization.
Yeah,
their separate chapters call themselves igloos. Igloo number four, igloo number eight.
I think they call them cabins down here.
Yeah,
But the ones in the Seattle area are no longer.
Oh, I see. Okay, there was a group or cabin igloo whatever in Seattle.
Right.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So the early collection, early part of their collection, from right after the Gold Rush, when they first formed, that part of the collection is really good. But the later years, if you lived in Alaska at one point in time, you could be a member.
Right.
So it's been watered down a lot, which I think is why they finally disbanded. And then the archives, and they have, the archives is the biggest part of their collection. So they have newspapers, whole newspapers, mine certificates,
like claim
papers. Mine claims and indentureships, like I say, diaries, journals, ledgers, and a whole bunch of receipts. So you get receipts for underwear, you get receipts for dogs, you get receipts for dry goods, and it's a lot. There's a lot of them.
Yeah, but that's how you could tell how much it would cost somebody to outfit
exactly.
and do this trip.
Exactly.
Yeah. Cool.
So it's a rich collection.
Yeah.
It's not a big collection.
No, well, I'm glad you did that summary.
But it is rich.
That's very helpful to hear that the different types of material and the different collections.
Yeah, and then there's like I say, Taryn, like it was a couple months ago, somebody called her up from Des Moines. And I'm thinking, she said, I drove to Des Moines, and I'm thinking, Iowa? You drove out to Iowa? And
there's actually a Des Moines here.
But we just get a call from somebody saying, hey, I was going through my aunt's attic after she passed away, and she got all this stuff. Do you guys want it?
That's often how museums and archives acquire things.
And honestly, it's great that people are thinking about donating it instead of selling it. There was a time period where everybody was selling everything on eBay and you weren't seeing anything coming in.
Right. Well, that's why I asked whether you guys acquired things through eBay, because I know some institutions have done that.
Park Service doesn't really have the budget to do that. I was doing an exhibit on the 1935 Winter Olympic Ski Trials, and we had programs. And we had photographs, but we had no objects. So visitors are okay with two-dimensional exhibit, but it's not as well-received as if you can put objects in there. So we searched eBay and found, like, the pins that they handed out to participants and were for sale, so we bought those. But they didn't become part of the collection.
Oh, didn't.
They're just exhibit props.
Oh, right.
If they're... I think these were reproductions, which was why. If they're period pieces, then they're treated like artifacts.
Right.
But if they're reproductions, then they're props.
No, that's interesting.
So, we will, okay, if we have exhibit money, we'll purchase items. Occasionally, somebody will call us and want to sell us their collection. And I'm going to say 9 out of 10 times, we can't do it. We don't have the money. We can't get it readily.
Mm-hmm.
But there are occasions when it's at Boston. Part of World War II, documenting World War II, was a bunch of people who painted the scenes at the shipyards and that sort of thing. So there were 3 paintings documenting the Boston Naval Shipyard during World War II. Building the ships and outfitting the ships and getting them ready to go. And we were able to talk the person into waiting until the Park Service could get the money. And so we were able to acquire those paintings.
Yeah, that's the downside of the Park Service, is the bureaucracy. You can't just act right away.
Yeah, our money is only 1 year, and it's usually already programmed for and completely spent before we even get it.
Right.
So if we want to do something like that, you have to know in advance that this is coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And when I do, like, if I know that there's a collection coming up, I'll put it in the budget and request in advance. And then it's all based on, okay, well, what's more important? Is getting this item more important than, you know, stocking toilet paper in the bathrooms? So you're competing with things that have nothing to do, you know, apples and oranges. And we don't go to the budget table. So they just see.
Right.
You want a painting and you want toilet paper. And it's up to, that's why it's important that Klondike, having the superintendents there, understand the importance of the collection. The apples and oranges can compete better.
Right.
There's at Mount Rainier, if I wanted a painting and they needed toilet paper, it's going to be toilet paper that's going to outcompete the painting. If the funding's there, we get it. Some parks will do year-end funding.
Mm-hmm.
So you take, our budgets go from October 1 to September 30th. And year-end funding, it starts in July. So some parks will take all the funds that haven't been expended by a certain date, pull it all back into the general pool, and then... So that's what happened at Boston, is they put in all that money back together. We needed $30,000 for those paintings. So we had, at that time, we had requisition forms. So we had the requisition forms already done. We had documentation on the paintings that told the history of them and explain why they were important.
Mm-hmm.
We had an exhibit plan, so we had all of our ducks in a row when we went into that end of year funding meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we were able to get the money, because they did it that way.
Right.
I worked at several parks where there isn't end of year money. It's, we know what our priorities are. We know it, that we're X number of thousands of dollars in the hole, so all the money goes to cover that hole.
Right.
Or we know that we're going to need an influx of toilet paper, so we do that. It's different management styles.
Mm-hmm.
I personally like the end of year.
Right.
Because then you can, you know, if they didn't spend it in the first...
9 months.
10, 11 months, then that brings it back.
Right.
Instead of them spending
it. And then other people can benefit from it.
Right.
But also, it's a different management styles. It also may be parks with different, missions. You know, if you're a high visitor use park, you maybe have to make sure you spend your money on visitor services more right. than you have to do on preserving insects.
Right. Right.
You know, and so that you're fighting that tide as well.
Right, right. And there's always the, what is the goals, the objectives for the year.
Right.
Where does what you need fit into those? Right. For some, it works, and for some others, it doesn't.
And if it doesn't work one year, you try again the next year?
Every year. Every year. So, I mean, it's not that it's falling on deaf ears, because everybody hears what you're requesting. And if you don't get it with the base funding or the end of year funding, there's other funding out there. And if somebody hears about it, and they'll call you and say, hey, we just heard about this funding. Mm-hmm. You know, it'd be perfect for what you need to do. And that's how we got the oil painting at mm-hmm. Mount Rainier fixed, because funding came from a different source.
And then, like, that end of year money, or that reallocation, who makes those decisions? The superintendent?
It's a group of people.
It's a group of people. Yeah. In the park, they...
Yeah.
Okay. So it's by committee, kind of.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Were talking about digitizing some of these photos. Mm-hmm. When you do that, is that then... Do they get put on a public website so people can search the collections themselves?
That's the end goal. We're not there yet.
Okay.
So I think I just gave Taryn. Yeah, she was just able to, because we have a limit as to how much we can send electronically. Mm-hmm. And one photograph,
right,
is beyond the limit already. We had to figure out how to get it to her without me having to drive it up there.
Send this file or Dropbox? Can you guys have, don't you have an FTP
site? Yeah, we have an FTP site.
Yeah.
But I also have a direct
right.
Drive. So okay. It took days, but we were able to get it onto the direct drive, and then she was able to upload it right. there at the park.
Because they're high-resolution images.
Yeah, they're anywhere from 25 megabytes to 90 megabytes, yeah. I think. So the end goal is that they be usable. For the Kenzie photographs, that is the agreement. We don't own the photographs, but we have written agreement to share them with the University of Washington, Washington State Historical Society. We can share them with Skagway, Dawson, mm-hmm. All the Canadian parks. But they, Seattle is also tasked with putting them up someplace where the public can see them too.
Yeah, because like University of Washington, University of Alaska, you know, we have all these digital archives.
Right.
So you can be in Boise, Idaho, searching for Gold Rush pictures at your computer. And so I didn't know if Seattle yet. Unit doesn't have that yet.
No, because we've had either other duty as assigned person or a curator who isn't there
mm-hmm.
Working on this collection. And it's the same with all the Park Service sites. We have one curator for two or three sites.
Yeah.
I think there's one curator who's got seven sites that she's responsible for.
Well, and even in Skagway, I don't think their collections are on a public
site. Yeah, they only have one person.
Right. So I don't think most parks, I don't think, have their materials on digital archives websites like the way university libraries are. They don't have all of their material, or Library of Congress or whomever. They
right.
don't have all their stuff, but they at least have a place you can look at some things. But the Park Service doesn't do that.
We don't have the staff, and honestly, we don't have the funding for it. You have to pay for those sites.
Right.
So we don't have the funding. Plus, there's IT issues.
The security issues.
Security issues, yeah. So
I always wondered why the Park Service doesn't have those kinds of sites.
It's primarily lack of staffing is what it is. But the goal is there. The desire is there. It's just getting to that point. That's why I have Dwight, and he's scanning. So we have 70,000 photographs of Mount Rainier, and he's scanned...
200.
No, he's actually up to 2 years now, so 8,000,
oh,
I think.
Oh, that's a lot.
So he's doing about 3,000 to 4,000 a year.
Wow, good for him.
Last year he did about 4,000 for Mount Rainier, and then he also did Klondike. So he did the Atwood collection at Klondike, and he did the Kinsey photographs, which are privately owned,
right.
But they were put in the public domain for the purposes of providing them. So those will be available. And I know Taryn's big on social media, so she will get the high resolution ones up and going as soon as she can.
Yeah.
So, takes time.
Right. And so, yeah, so if somebody wants to use the collection at Klondike, Seattle, they have to physically go to headquarters and do research in the collection?
Yes and no. If you know specifically what you're looking for, and we have the time and resources to look for it, then we'll do that. If you're in the Seattle area... We may tell you you need to come in and do it, make an appointment and do it. But if you're not in the Seattle area, generally we'll do it.
But like your finding aids, none of it's online available. It's all
no, but we can send it to people.
Yeah, I mean, it's all PDFs you could send or something.
Yeah, so somebody calls me, I will send them the finding aid.
That's
what they're looking for, or I will suggest photographs.
Do you ever do collections research for, if there's a researcher, let's say, you know, doing a book on the women and they, and say, oh, I want to know what you have in your collections. Would you guys do that for a researcher, or you'd say you have to come and do it yourself?
Depends on the extent. If they just want to know what books we have on women in the Klondike, then yeah, we can tell them what books we have. If they want to know what's inside those books, they're going to have to either come themselves or hire somebody.
Right.
We just don't have the staffing levels to do that. We have more staff than we did when I started, but it's still, the levels aren't enough.
Yeah.
Given the responsibilities we have.
Okay.
With the workload. But it's, there are, the collections are open to the public. We welcome the public. But it's legitimate research, not just come and see what's in our attic type stuff.
Right, right,
So, and we do give like Washington National Park Fund is a big friends organization that raises money for the national parks in this area, and they will do membership work groups. So at one point they did a work group where they came and helped out in the collections at Mount Rainier. And as part of that, we gave them a tour of the collections area so they could see what a collections storage facility looks like.
Right.
Well, an example of one.
Well, and that's like the National Museum Day and things like that, that museums will open the back rooms for people to come tour, you know, escorted in a tour setting.
Right. And we do that with school groups.
Yeah.
The education coordinator at Klondike will work with curation and the school groups. To get them exposure to curatorial work. Out here, the school actually contacts me directly to set up a day where the 6th, 7th, and 8th graders come through. So every 3 years, I get all three age groups.
That must be fun.
It is. It's a challenge, though, because the teachers are on the ball, so they're teaching things. So, for example, they said, well, we're going to do natural history. So they have a theme.
Right.
1 year was natural history. Well, they'd already taught them how to mount specimens, you know, plant specimens.
Right.
So it was like, okay, well, what's the hands-on that we're going to do? Because that would be the easiest
right.
natural history one for us to do. So we're always having to come up with something that they have not already taught.
And the idea is that it's a hands-on. It's not just showing them, hey, this is this cool,
right.
you know, gold pick that somebody used.
Right. So we work, we do, we split the kids up because there's so many of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so one will learn what it is a curator does. One group will go to that spot, learn what it is we do, learn a little history about the park and the park service. And then another group is actually taking tours, going through the collections, or showing us specific things
mm-hmm.
that are relevant to the theme the teacher's trying to teach. I think the last one was cultural resources. So we did a lot of cultural, showing them
mm-hmm.
archives and three-dimensional objects, not so much the natural history
right.
stuff. And then the last group is a hands-on that they...
Like build an acid-free box.
yeah, something like that, which is a good one.
Yeah.
So it's making it going around. I think we did for the hands-on was... exhibits, making fake documents, reproductions to go on exhibit so that you didn't damage your original.
That's cool. So you also make a mount for something. That might be too technical. I don't know.
Oh, well, it involves knives and...
Oh, yeah. That's true.
You're talking 6th to 8th grade.
Yeah,
so. No,
that's true.
I mean, they'll listen to you and they'll do what you say, but there's a lot of them and very few
yeah.
chaperones, so.
Right.
But it's a lot of fun.
And did Klondike do that kind of a program, too? Or
did
they bring the kids in?
I don't think we have. I think we've, it's more we come, they learn about the history of Klondike, and so they use the collections to make reproduction props and stuff for the teachers'
mm-hmm.
kits.
Okay.
I think the curator or one of my volunteers or interns may have talked to the groups.
Yeah.
But not an actual what does a curator do
right.
type thing. Keith may have done something in his time period. It's hard when you're
yeah.
2 hours away.
You're only there part-time.
To accommodate it, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, your dogs are telling us, I think, that it's time to stop, unless you have something else that you had thought you wanted to talk about.
I don't think so.
Okay. Well, let the dogs out. Who let the dogs out? Well, thank you, Brooke.
You're welcome.